Well, it looks like we probably ultimately will. Although, you know, I wouldn't want to be in there. It's a funny map. It's pretty
sweet. I don't know if you're really expecting to pass it, but driving.
Sometimes easier to think first.
I don't know. I don't know how you really look at
this has been good.
About
this
thing, and I know that it probably hasn't.
Although it's not a lot.
It'd be interesting to see, like, especially on the
project. The ability for DWI to vote people.
Okay.
So they took that
district,
and they reduced
have, like,
one part of their small
in
the
district. So each comes from this.
Surcharge
and it's
the however the 250 so a person has to pay 300 total.
So you need different representation.
In this building.
Yeah. So it is substantially less. You know, it's $300 instead of I did prepare an amendment. I wasn't sure if anybody wanted it or not. it retains their, you know, 430 goes down to 50. But retains that, but then it puts back two new consumer features so that the $300 total could still be. I don't know whether anybody wants it. I haven't told anybody else that there is, but here if the committee wants to amend her bill.
Look at,
so as to, yes, we like the idea of reducing the surcharge, but
you look at,
given the large view, we still want to work.
Because the city actually does look different. You look at northeast, northwest. That you could almost as easily drive across that way. Sort of.
Oh, yeah.
Drunken drivers.
Anyway, that's just FYI.
With the housing stock.
Who offering it? Or?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't talked to Senator Watt. I actually think, because when I talked to Ken Backus, who was in Judiciary Council, he realized that 250 fee was still in there. I mean, he thought that it was just the, that this was the only.
Even less, it's largely that.
Surcharge, he didn't realize he was going to. So I don't know if Senator Watt is even exactly aware of this provision.
That's what I heard, but maybe I was mistaken.
Is it starting right?
Yeah, but we're going to be here all night. We might as well start.
Speed of wood. Thank you. Can you come up with a better idea overnight? Works for me.
Do this, and then I'm sure we'll lose it.
Any amendments in here already?
No. Oh, no. We don't pass them.
Already?
Maybe that'll be the same.
No, I think we're just policy today, aren't we? Just policy today. Yeah.
I think we're
just Senate Transportation Committee, that's all. Yeah.
Senate Transportation Committee will come to order. Today we have a rather large sheet of bills that we need to go through, so we're going to try to do things rather promptly. Even though we started not promptly, we had a lot of pre-arranging to do here. But we're going to ask if people who don't have to testify that they perhaps could either keep their comments very short or perhaps pass them on to your main testifier. What we're going to do is we're going to start out with Senator Kubley on Senate File 2761. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2761 was introduced at the request of a number of folks who live in my district. I happen to live in a district that's fairly heavily populated by these flashing lights that MnDOT put out there, you know, and in the opinion of most of the people that I talk to, it's a way of postponing plowing the roads. And, you know, MnDOT says that they're for safety reasons, and yet, you know, if you look at where the traffic comes from, I would say at least three-fourths of the traffic, 75-80% of the traffic, enters the roadway at a place where there are no lights. And so the lights are really of not much value, even though they are pretty regulatory in nature. So, you know, I think one of the things that rubs people the wrong way is the signs that say they're going to get a $700 fine if they're driving on the road when the light is flashing, you know, that kind of thing. But, it does seem to me that it's kind of heavy-handed on an idea that really is not very well thought out. I'm sure there's somebody from MnDOT who would like to speak in opposition to the bill, but from my perspective, at least, it seems to me that the few things that I've already mentioned, entering the roadway where there is no flashing light, the punitive nature of the flashing lights, and the postponing of plowing the roads in a timely fashion. It seems to me that plowing the roads in the same way that they were plowed in the past would be, much safer than having a few flashing lights out there. So I guess I know your agenda is crowded, Mr. Chair, so I'll leave my comments at that.
Mr. Chairman?
We're passing out an A1 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
It's not, Mr. Chair. I think your administrator there made that up with the idea that what follows in the bill already covers that language, and so the language really isn't needed above. It follows in another section of the bill.
It's just technical.
Well, it looks like we need to move this amendment. So,
I have no objection to the amendment, Mr. Chair. Okay. I don't think it changes anything. Okay. It just cleans up the language a little bit.
Okay. Senator Olsen moves the amendment, the A1 amendment to Senate File 2761. On page 2, line 11, it deletes the new language and strike misdemeanor. Any questions on the amendment? Any discussion? All in favor of the amendment, say aye. All opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Okay, now, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. could you just elaborate a little bit on the part about they may not restrict the use beyond the expiration of the target time range for snow removal? What are those set? Can you explain?
Well,
Senator Kubley,
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, my understanding is that MnDOT has a target time range for in which snow would be removed. I think the perception, at least in my district, where that's fairly heavily endowed with these lights, and there aren't significant numbers of them in most parts of the state. You know, there's a couple in Senator Lanx's district. There are quite a few in mine and a number of them in Senator Vickerman's district, but they aren't used all over the state. They're just used in parts of the state that are not very heavily populated, and so I frankly agree with the idea that it's just a way to postpone snow removal, which is the best safety measure that can be taken, and allow them to put off plowing the roads in the same timely fashion that it was done prior to the lights installment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, well, it seemed to me that where those lights and barricades are tend to be kind of the windswept areas where there's a lot of blowing and drifting snow and visibility more so than because you don't have a lot of obstruction in less populated areas, that tends to be the case.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson. You know, I don't disagree with closing the roads when the visibility is low, but the reality is that you could turn those lights on across the district and the visibility might be just fine in one area, and 9-10 miles away you can hardly see your hand in front of your face. So, you know, again, I mean, you know, one of my sheriffs is here, and I'm not going to identify him, but I asked him his idea, and he didn't think they were a great idea either. So, you know, it does seem to me that there are at least varied opinions on this, but I don't personally see it as something that is really very functionally useful. I do think it's, and maybe MnDOT has come and visited with you, and that's fine, you know, but, I don't object, certainly, to closing roads, and that's usually on the radio that the roads are closed, you know, so I think, you know, traffic, people know, you know, to stay home if the visibility is so poor you can't see where you're going, but on the other hand, once again, I would emphasize that most of the traffic doesn't enter the roads where they're going to be able to see a light anyway, or even a barricade for that matter, but, you know, where does it end? I mean, you know, it just seems to me that this is a little heavy-handed on the regulatory side, and I think we ought to go back to the ways that we were handling the situations before then, and I don't think we want to compromise anyone's safety at all. You know, it's just that, you know, plowing the roads is a much safer way of handling the problem than turning on some lights or even putting up a barricade. And, you know, I think the road needs to be closed at certain times when the visibility is so poor that you can't see very far down the road. But I'm not sure that this is a thing. You know, to me, it's a gross misuse of funding at a time when funding was short for MnDOT anyway, and it's been kind of a burr under the saddle of a lot of folks out there that didn't see any problem with the method that we had for maintaining the safety of our residents before.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Just a follow-up. The point I was kind of curious about in relation to the target time range for snow removal, you indicated that one of your reasons for not allowing them to restrict beyond, and that this is an excuse for them to take longer in terms of their snow plowing. I've often found that the principle that there's nothing that we can come up with that somebody can't find a way around, and by the way, the MnDOT has not lobbied me on this at all.
Okay.
This is the first I knew of your bill as walking in here today. But might this drive them, if this law were in place, to extend those target ranges in order that they don't, just plan to take longer? Because if they've got this hoop to jump through, why jeopardize why jeopardize whatever the punishment is that would go along with it, and just said we're going to take longer? Can we really change the behavior by doing that?
Well, Mr.
Senator
Chair
Cooper.
And Senator Olson, you know, I think that was in place, before the lights were put up. But, you know, it seems to me that, you know, the lights have not really functioned in the capacity for which they were intended, primarily because too much of the traffic enters the roadway at a point where there aren't any lights. You know, they're not putting them up at every intersection.
So is your issue the lights?
Senator
Olson. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
It's primarily
Senator
the lights, Mr. Chair.
Huh? It's the lights that are the issue rather than the issue. They say that they're not supposed to restrict use or close, but for this time range. And so it isn't the length of time that they're taking to open the roads as much as it is the closure by using these lights and barricades that you're that's at issue for you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think that the primary issue is the removal of snow from the roadway. Yes, you know, I think, you know, I initially, you know, I heard about that pretty regularly, that, you know, people were disgusted that their roads weren't being plowed. The state roads used to be plowed before the county and the township roads were plowed, but now the state is behind the county and the township roads. So it just seems to me that, you know, when these lights and things come onto the roadway, you know, not too long after they've changed the plowing calendar, well, you know, that's kind of where it came down. And so people assume that there's a connection between the lights that tell them they're not supposed to drive on the roadway and the announcement of the intention to delay the plowing of the roads, you know, although that wasn't publicly known right away. It was kind of uncovered by a couple radio people in the area. And in my area, I don't know if it's true across the state. I suspect it is. I mean, some of the snow removal equipment has been sold. And, you know, then personnel at the truck stations aren't replaced in a timely fashion. And so, you know, I don't know. It just seems to be a real mess right now. Hopefully we can get that straightened out and get back on track.
Senator Dade, did you have a question? No. Any others? Did you have a testifier in opposition that was ready to testify? Is there someone from the department?
I didn't ask anyone to come, Mr. Chair, but
they're sneaking up behind
there's
you.
Someone here.
Yes. Please identify yourself for the record, and please try to be as briefly as possible.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT, and I'd like to think that we're only temporarily in a disagreement about something.
Okay.
I think we understand that Senator Kubley's concern is that the plowing in our southwestern districts isn't meeting his expectations. And both of our districts have said that the district engineer and the personnel out there would be more than happy to sit down with Senator Kubley and talk about whether they're meeting the expectations of the citizens and what we could do to improve our service or to better explain how we provide it. I think that this bill, though, does not really address our plowing performance. And, in fact, our plowing performance has nothing to do with whether or not the department decides that it's important to close a road. The reference to the target range for snow removal starts at the end of the snowfall, when the snow is not falling, and then we can actually get it removed from the road. The time when we need to close roads is when the snow is falling so heavily or blowing so heavily that it's literally either useless or not safe to have plows on the road trying to remove it, and we want to close the roads to protect the public. And Mr. Lund, who is the state's maintenance engineer, can explain how seldom we actually do that. But the goal with respect to closing roads has nothing to do with a desire not to be held to reasonable standards about clearing lanes. It has to do with the roads becoming impassable and the impossibility of keeping them open safely. The same argument holds for the use of flashing lights. Flashing lights that are remotely controlled were erected so that we wouldn't have to send crews out there with trucks to unload barrels and put up barricades when the weather is at its very worst. And if we're not meeting snow performance standards, then I apologize for that, and we'll do everything we can to rectify that. But it doesn't really have anything to do with the department's need when the roads are not safe to be able to close them.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
you know,
Senator Cooper.
I stated to Senator Olson, you know, I have no problem with MnDOT closing roads when safety is a question. you know, I think there are times when the road needs to be closed, but that going out over the airwaves, I mean, people listen quite attentively, I think, to their radio stations when it is snowing and blowing to find out about whether the roads are passable or not. So from my perspective, I think this is a new wrinkle. You know, it's a new wrinkle that wasn't very well thought out, and, you know, they're just not willing to admit that they made an error. At least that would be my perception. You know, it seems to me that, you know, this body is the regulatory body. We've given too much over to departments that allow them to make regulations that we haven't put into place ourselves. You know, I think it's time to take a stand and say enough is enough, and we're going to do the regulatory piece from this time forward.
Mr. Lund, you would like to speak to this, and I guess I'm hoping that you're going to really define what this the targeted range is for us.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Lund. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Really, I was going to just repeat everything that Ms. Parker said, probably not as well, but again, I think she covered the points, but I'd be happy to answer any specifics regarding this road closure situation. Two points that I might make are that this bill would potentially or could force MnDOT to open a road when we consider it still in a dangerous condition. And also, as Ms. Parker said, we think that the real issue is maybe dissatisfaction with our plowing operations or tactics or strategies. And again, our local district engineers in that area, along with the maintenance engineers, would be more than willing to sit down and discuss our procedures and our strategies for snow removal.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, you know, once again, I mean, I doubt if MnDOT can document that there has been a change in the number of incidents that involve any safety issue with the installation of these lights. You know, I just don't believe that there's that kind of data out there. I think that people, they pay attention to the radio. They know when the roads are closed. I mean, and to Mr. Lund's credit, I appreciate the fact that he did come and visit with me. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, at a time, you know, to put these lights out there at a time when MnDOT was struggling for dollars anyway, just seems to me to be, you know, a colossal waste of limited resources. But, you know, maybe they can find some other state that thinks they're a good idea. I think we ought to, you know, eliminate them in Minnesota and go back to putting it on the public airwaves as a public announcement and, you know, let people, you know, decide on their own what they're, whether they have roads that are passable or not. I mean, you can usually tell out in the country by looking out the window whether or not you want to go anywhere. So, you know, I think it's it just seems to me that it's something that that was not called for and something that should be within the realm of the legislature, not of a department.
Senator Scoia.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Coublier. I mean, I think you raise a number of issues that we should be considering, particularly the penalty for being on the road. If you happen to get on the road between the flashing lights, you haven't seen that. So I think, Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate File Number 2761 be laid over for possible inclusion in the transportation policy omnibus bill.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, because of the A1 amendment,
we do have a motion.
Oh.
So we should speak to the motion first. Is that correct?
Well,
yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, there
should be discussion on the bill.
Discussion, let's have the
motion's out there.
Okay. Yes, Senator Olsen.
On the A1 amendment, I noticed it struck misdemeanor, but then on line 3.26, Well, the end of 3.25 and 3.26, it again says petty misdemeanor, and I'm wondering if that shouldn't be changed also.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olsen. I think the intent was that it wasn't needed in the language above that because it was repeated below, and so it's just a repetition of the information that's already there.
I think we have some more information that Ms. Loverell would like to provide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carol Loverell with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And while we're not in opposition to this bill, we do have concerns with the language starting on 1.16. We thought there'd be an amendment to change this. But as the language reads, it would include some of our county state aid highways that are the same classification as MnDOT trunk highways. And so we would urge some language here, and I think Mr. Lund had some language that would make this just specific to MnDOT and not infer the counties would be held to this same standard.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cooley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that issue could be addressed possibly by changing line 114 and 219 to say, you know, a state trunk highway, or, you know, maybe council has a different recommendation that would fit in there too.
Senator Kubley, would you like to have us lay this over and then work on the language, and then we can act on Senator Skoy's motion to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
I think that would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Senator Day.
I was Chairman and Senator Kubley, when they're flashing those lights out there, keep in mind that there's some people around here that would like to get rid of about 150 of these ramp meters. So maybe what we could do is we could include them in there, because they even flash red and green and blues and all sorts of colors. So maybe we should look at kind of combining some of them also, because they're kind of aggravating a lot of people also.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Day,
Senator Cooley.
My daughter-in-law would agree with you. She said that on her trip to and from work, it slowed her down one way but sped her up another way. So she didn't feel that it made more than 1 minute difference between her trip, whether they were on or off. So,
was that a 1 minute gained or 1 minute lost?
Senator Day.
She just said that it didn't make more than a 1 minute difference between the time she left home and arrived at work, or left work and arrived at home.
That's a successful program for $59 million.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move on. We're going to take up the motion. Any other questions on the motion?
Which motion?
The motion to lay over the bill.
For possible inclusion.
For possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, I thought we were going to lay it over so he could work on that language and then look at it again.
And for possible inclusion, yes.
Okay, well, I've got other questions on the, if I could, on the bill.
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, could you explain the language on lines 218. Why? I guess I'm not quite understanding the new civil action, because this says if the roads have been, the snow's been removed, then a civil action. I guess I'm wondering why we need that new language and what's its purpose.
Well,
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, you know, I guess it's been a while since I looked at that, but if the snow is removed, Yeah, it doesn't seem to me. I see what you mean.
Senator Kubley, we'll have Senate counsel give up some information on it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and
members. Berezovsky.
The existing language in Subdivision 9 provides for civil liability already for a person who is on a closed road. And what the new language says is that that civil action may be maintained against the person who was on a closed road only if the okay. snow had been removed. Well, I shouldn't say a closed road because the road was open, but they shouldn't be liable for rescue costs as long as unless the snow has been removed. So in other words, it's saying you can't hold a person liable if they entered the road and it was closed, say if they didn't know, for example, that the barricade was up somewhere else, the lights were flashing somewhere else. They entered the road. They cannot be held liable for rescue costs at that point.
Mr. Chair, Senate Counsel, can they now? I guess I'm wondering, because aren't they allowed to charge back? Aren't the municipalities allowed to charge right now if in a rescue? And so this would, Mr. Chair, this would prevent that?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, it would limit it. It would say that the state has to have done its job in order to be able to turn back to the, you know, for the political subdivision to turn back to the individual who was on the road and hold that person civilly liable.
To that point, Mr. Chair?
And I'll think of my question.
Senator Olson.
Well, to that point, isn't that kind of a catch-22? Part of the difficulty of removing the snow is you got abandoned vehicles in the way.
But that?
People. About rescuing.
Well, if there are people or vehicles,
they have a car out there.
It's hard. How do you get the snow removed if the cars are stuck in it? I mean, to have that be a condition of being able to charge if they've entered, you know, in, when they shouldn't have, whether it was the radio announcing it or the lights are flashing or whatever it was. This says they can only pursue a civil action for that if all the snow has been removed and the highway reopened.
Correct.
In that target range. And that that gets in the way of achieving the target range if you've got all these vehicles out there. That's the point. Well, that's why we've got the penalty in the first place.
Senator Olson, the council is saying that they can remove the vehicles as part of the clearing.
But they can't.
And then now they can charge back. Isn't that correct, Ms. Berezovsky?
Mr. Chair, they can charge back only if the state has done the job that is given to them in this bill. If they haven't done the job, if they're not out there clearing the roads, then they cannot charge back.
But Mr. Chair and Council, it says if the snow was removed and reopened within that targeted time range. I think the issue of charging them is the fact that they're having gotten stuck when they shouldn't be out there is what gets in the way of their being able to remove the snow in a timely fashion. And now you say they can remove the vehicles. I don't know. I know we got some pretty big plows, but can they go right through and plow those cars right off the out of the way too?
Some additional information, Senator Dibble.
Well, I'll take a crack at it. This is, I think I'm starting to understand what this new language hopes to accomplish. As I understand it, if, for instance, someone goes out on a road that's closed, and they went out for whatever reason, whether they knew it was closed or not, and they get stuck, and then they get rescued after the standard time has passed to clear the road, then they can't be held civilly liable for that rescue because the agency hasn't lived up to its obligations under Senator Kubley's bill. If they go out on a closed road and are rescued before the time has elapsed for the for MnDOT to clear the road, then they can be held civilly liable as they would mm-hmm. under normal circumstances. So it just creates kind of a clear, bright line that Senator Kubley is trying to achieve, setting forth this timeline, the standard of road clearance for MnDOT. And after that time passes, then, you know, kind of everything is on MnDOT's dime and time.
But I think
the issue of clearing the roads with cars out there is a different issue. I mean, I think the plows probably go up to where the cars are, and they stop and then call out a tow truck and or a rescue vehicle of some sort and get the person in the car out of there, and then the plows continue on their way.
Well, Mr. Chair, and
Senator Kubley, let's make sure that we go a little bit faster, and then let's see. Get the information out, and then
I can
probably lay it over.
From making comments, if you like, Mr. Chair. I guess you know it does seem to me. I don't know, what it's like in other people's districts, but I've been out on the roads after a snowfall and after the plows have cleared the roads, and it seems to me that the cars that are abandoned are not on the roadway. maybe they are, and maybe there is an occasional one that is, but most of them are in the ditch. They're not on the roadway, so I don't know if that would be a big problem, even if it were the other way around.
We have a motion to lay this over, and I think evidently we do not have to vote on that motion. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to have you take this and see if you can work out some cooperative language, or perhaps that can take care of some of the objections.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the department has a little language they'd like to add as well.
Okay. Ms. Parker, you'd like to add a few more words?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that there are serious misunderstandings about what this bill means, including the language about when a civil action may be maintained and the alleged link between meeting our goals and whether or not we may close a road. This law was originally written because lives of rescuers had been put at risk in the southwest part of the state during years when we were having serious blizzards. And it's much more about the risk to people who have to go out and rescue people. I have a clipping from the Marshall Independent from just last year, which was the first time that these flashing lights were used in that area, in which the paper reported that troopers responded to 150 motorists' assists. This was March 1st to March 3rd, in the form of stranded motorists, stalled vehicles, vehicles off the road, or abandoned vehicles during a very severe snowstorm in March last year. And I do recall that at that time there was a lot of anger expressed at the department because we used the flashing lights. And we are faced with making a choice. We know that people want to get places, that they need to get their kids, they need to get home, but there are times when it simply isn't safe to travel, when it's very difficult or impossible to keep roads open. And this bill attempts to link the decision, the safety decision, should the road be open or not, with whether or not, when there is not a blizzard, can MnDOT meet its plowing goals. We will never, ever meet our plowing goals when there is a blizzard going on. It's just a fact of life. We don't even try when it's like that. It's when the storm ceases that our plowing goals come into effect, and we give ourselves a certain number of hours to get out there and get those lanes cleared. And those are based on market research with citizens. But there is no link between meeting our goals after the storm stops and the decision that we have to make about whether or not to close a road. And I just think it's very important that it be recognized that those two things are linked in a very artificial fashion in this bill. And the bill, I believe, although it's well-intentioned, is a punitive approach to unhappiness with the department's plowing in some cases. And that can be addressed in another venue. If you lay this over for inclusion in the policy bill, and I've seen this happen many times, it gets swept up with 20 or 30 other bills it gets passed into law, you will basically have taken the step of telling the department, we may not close roads under any condition.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Senator Cooper,
you know, the things that, you know, and once again, I mean, I would say that, you know, it is not my intent to jeopardize anyone's safety. You know, that is not the intent of this at all. I think, you know, some of the primary reasons that people call me are what they see as the overly punitive regulatory efforts of MnDOT to do something that they have no clue about. You know, if we're not putting it on the airwaves, how are people going to find out about it? You know, I don't know. Maybe they still do that. I hope they do. But these lights are not the answer. You know, they're going to let a very limited number of people who are using a roadway know whether it's open or not. It just isn't a workable idea. I applaud their efforts at maintaining safety. I don't want to jeopardize workers at MnDOT. I don't want to jeopardize anyone who lives in my area who might be out on the roadway that, is in an event when the lights are flashing. I mean, I would hope that they wouldn't go at that time. But, you know, I don't think whether the lights are flashing or not is going to make any difference to those folks, because they're not going to be able to see them. If it's not on the radio, if it's not on the TV set, they have no way of knowing whether it's open or closed.
Thank you. Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Parker, you know, by making the motion that I made, my intent was to lay it on the table so that Senator Murphy could keep working on this to see if there's some language that would meet the department's abilities and his needs. I would have thought that the committee, when the omnibus policy bill was put together, came forward. If this provision was included, when it wasn't resolved, we would have taken it out. But if you don't like the motion to lay it on the table for possible inclusion, we can move to lay it on the table for further discussion, which is basically the same thing, I think. But
yes.
I'll withdraw the motion for possible inclusion and move that Senate File 2761 be laid on the table.
Normally, that's not a motion that we would vote on, but we will.
Yeah.
So we're going to vote on laying it on the table, and what we're going to, we'll take it off the table and rehear the amended version of it. All right. Any questions on that?
It's not debatable.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's pick on Senate File 2539, Senator Dibble.
After that one.
Oh, we've made changes again.
Right.
For Fine Green Acres to tillable.
Senator Dibble, quick like a fox.
All right, Mr. Chair, this is a fairly simple bill, and we'll have to move it on to finance because it does have a fiscal note, Mr. Chair. So what we propose to do, Mr. Chair, with Senate File 2539 is to waive the fee to issue Minnesota IDs for senior citizens 65 and older. And the goal, Mr. Chair and members, is to allow those seniors who can't afford the $11 fee to be able to make use of Metro Transit senior discount and use the Minnesota ID for the purpose of proving their age. The major issue that was brought to our attention with the alternative available to them, which is carrying their Medicare card, is that to carry the Medicare card around with them regularly You know, should they lose it, means that their social security number would get out, and a lot of seniors are nervous about that. Otherwise, the alternative to the Medicare card, of course, is getting a Minnesota ID that is proof of their age, and that costs $11. And so this waives the fee for that purpose. Mr. Chair, Doug Davis from the Minneapolis Senior Citizen Advisory Committee is here to testify, and then we'll hear from Charles Rosensteel, who's also on the Senior Citizen Advisory Committee, and they support this and have endorsed this request.
Mr. Chairman,
please,
members
please
of the committee.
Please state your name for the record. Thank
My
you.
Name is Doug Davis. I'm a lifetime resident of Minneapolis. I have advocated for senior citizens at the legislature for many years on various issues. Today, I'm testifying in support of Senate File 2539. The bill authorizes the state to issue an identity card for senior citizens, and the problem it attempts to deal with is identity theft. We are all aware that there seems to be a stepped-up effort to defraud senior citizens, and what these thieves need from us is critical information, the Social Security number, or credit card number, or our bank account number. All or almost all of us know enough not to reveal our Social Security number. They tell us to leave it at home, and we do. Senior citizens are extensive users of public transit. When I sold my home in northeast Minneapolis, I was foresighted enough to get an apartment on the Bryant-Johnson bus line, otherwise known as the Snooseville Trolley. There would come a time, I was sure, when I would have to depend on the bus for getting around. We, the Senior Citizens Advisory Committee of Minneapolis, did a survey several years ago, and we found out that one-third or one out of every three senior citizens in the city did not or could not drive. They depended on the Metro buses for the mobility. But when we want to take advantage of the reduced rate to ride the bus, we are expected to carry our Medicare card to show it to the bus driver, to identify us as a senior citizen. Unfortunately, our Medicare card also includes our Social Security number. Senate File 2539 would allow us to use a state-issued card which would identify us as senior citizens and allow us to board the bus without having to carry our Medicare card and show it to the driver and run the risk of revealing our Social Security number. I urge, Mr. Chairman and members, I urge your support for Senate File 2539. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rosensteel can forego his testimony in the interest of time. He did have, he did want to just show him very quickly your
This is, I picked this up at, it's a
Mr. Rosensteel.
MTC bus schedule, number two bus. And on the back it says, for the discount, Medicare card holders to qualify, show Medicare card along with a photo ID. And that's what we're trying to get away from because of the Social Security number is on the Medicare card. I thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have the A1 amendment, which just simply says we're appropriating from the general fund for this purpose. And if I can move the A1 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment, which makes two changes. Page 1, line 16, after appropriated, insert from the general fund. Does everyone need to get that first, or can we vote on it? Senator Dibble, would you wish to fill in the appropriation amount also on your bill?
Oh, sure. Well, I suppose, Mr. Chair, we'll just
we'll take that as the next amendment.
We'll go off the or I can amend the amendment and insert the dotted line on that same line. Council can help me. Is it I'm getting confused between the special funds and the special revenue fund and the
It's 175. 4,409. Yeah. But then we're in the next biennium. So what do you say? What do you think? It's just a 1 year.
Ms. Berezovsky will give us a number.
Mr. Chair, according to the fiscal note, $174,000 is the cost for fiscal 09. So you could insert $174,000 at 1.16 in the blank, and then is appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety for fiscal year 09.
Okay. All right. I'll make that motion or that amendment to my amendment.
This is an amendment to your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So we're now voting on the amendment as orally amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File 2539 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Does it go to Finance or does it go to? Senator Dibble moves Senate File 2539 as amended be forwarded to Finance. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, one quick question, if I may. Senator Dibble, if a senior is age 65, you know, say they have their driver's license till age 90, does it lay out anywhere how that transition would work? I mean, their driver's license is good as long as they're able to drive. Is that correct?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Senator Olsen.
So then once somebody Once somebody would lose their driver's license, then this is when they would apply for that?
Senator Dibble.
Yes.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
No. I have a driver's license, but what I want this card for is that I can get on the bus on 29th and Johnson without having to show my Medicare card. That's all.
Senator Olsen?
I saw what you said about the Medicare card, but isn't your driver's license adequate identification?
No.
Okay.
Charlie, show him the
He schedule. Showed me. I saw.
The schedule shows specifically says on it that
Mr.
you
Davis.
Must have your Medicare card.
Medicare card plus
Mr. Chairman.
Your picture card. Your license, you can get a license with a T on it if you drive. But then that expires. In the neighborhood where I live, I get many reports from senior citizens that are living off of $800 a month.
Mr. Rosenstead, please speak closer to the mic so we can keep it on record. Here.
And renew to get it. They don't drive a car, and to get a driver's license would be too big of an expense for them.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm missing something here. So I'm a senior citizen, so I ride the bus or I ride the light rail or whatever. I don't never show anybody anything. What?
If you don't show your Medicare card and an ID, you can't get on. You can't get a discount.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dave.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, how much is the discount?
Only 50 cents it costs you to get on the bus with a discount.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
Hopefully, the seniors know that we just raised your gas tax. I voted against it, but we raised your gas tax. So if you drive 15,000 miles, cost you $37.50 a year more if you get 20 miles a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
On the floor the other day, we tried to freeze anybody that lived in a home. 25 years, we tried to freeze the property taxes, and it seemed like Senator Dibble and quite a few people voted against that.
Not going to bite on this.
So I guess if we want to keep the bus system, we're presently about $30 million in the hole on our transit.
Mm-hmm.
we have this $900 or $800 million fancy train that's carrying people around that you really don't even have to buy a ticket to ride it if you want. Just jump on and ride it. Nobody takes tickets. And now we're saying we're going to go one step further and that you can come on and ride it for a little bit of nothing. And I don't know if I gather that because I, even being a senior, and I, maybe my seniors are different in the city that I live in, but sooner or later, we're all going to have to pay the freight, and we can't be dumping this on, as I hear all the time around here, on our children and our grandchildren. I hear that normally always from seniors that tell me, and now I guess I'm wondering, aren't I dumping this back on my children and grandchildren?
That what I'm talking about is that discount is not any time. I cannot go on the bus in the evening and pay 50 cents. I have to pay full fare. That 50 cents is only on non-rush hours. And that, after that, you pay full fare.
I renew my
Senator
motion.
Dibble.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like
Senator
to say,
Day.
I mean, we're now...
I might be able to answer one question, Senator Day.
What we do, Mr. Chairman, is we tax the heck out of people over here. We don't think nothing about it. Then somebody comes over here with $176,000, and we think this is a wonderful deal. And it doesn't make any sense to me. We're taxing people out of their homes, and yet we got to give them so they can ride the bus for 50 cents and show cards and whatever. And I just doesn't – I don't get it, but –
Well, Senator Day, I might respond just one item here. This is about an identification card, eliminating the fee for an identification card to avoid identity theft. This isn't just to ride the bus. So let's vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, same sign. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll take Senator Fischbach's bill next. Is that correct?
Let's do it. Senator Fischbach, Senate File 1008. Okay, Senator Fischbach, you promised to be very brief.
We will. Mr. Chair, we will be as brief as we possibly can, but I do know that these fine gentlemen with guns do have a few things to say. So, but I do want to add the A1 amendment. We have a delete all amendment that would put the bill in the form that this committee has seen several times. So I think and deals with the commercial driver's license issue. So
okay,
it's
we are passing out the A1 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, while they're handing that out, I can just say
Senator
a few
Fischbach.
Words about it. You know, basically, this is the administrative fines bill, and this would allow counties and cities to issue administrative fines. We have been talking about this for a while. This, as after we put the amendment on, this is the same language that we voted on, I believe it was last year, and maybe even the year before, or several times last year. But this is this would be the language that passed out of here attached to the Foley bill last year. So this would clear up the gray area that we have currently in the language in the statute, whether or not cities and counties can issue these administrative fines. So this will make sure that they're able to do that. And I don't know if the A1 amendment has been passed out, because I'll offer that amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Fischbach offers the A1 amendment, and I believe everyone has their copy. Any questions on the A1 amendment? All in favor? Senator Gimsey does not have a copy yet. Okay, the A1 amendment is an amendment by the author. And I believe you're one of the authors. It's a delete all. So this is a delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All, right. All those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Senator Fischbach.
Thank you. I will turn it over to the sheriff or the chief, whoever wants to start first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheriff Mikkel Wetzel. I'm from Morrison County, Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in support of Senator Fischbach's bill. I've been here before in front of this committee, I believe three or four times, and I've given a very brief overview of why we believe more administrative citations are appropriate, and I'll be very brief today. I simply want to say that we instituted administrative citations when we realized back in 2003 that the cost of receiving a minor petty misdemeanor violation state ticket had become disproportionately high. It simply costs too much. Now, I know that folks in the Twin Cities do make more money than those in outstate Minnesota, but $120 at that time violation was the cheapest one you could get. And a farm worker or a worker at one of our boat factories very realistically would not eat lunch for 2 weeks if they were a little bit late for work and pushed the envelope. And that was unacceptable to me as the sheriff, and I organized a system where our officers could issue these tickets, still get the point across that speeding was inappropriate, but not be so punitive as to essentially wreck their entire 2 or 3 weeks. So I believe they're appropriate to use. They are certainly fair. They're certainly just. And they're in the best interest of the citizens of Morrison County. If that's true, I see no reason to believe why they wouldn't be in the best interest of the citizens in each of your counties as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Vern. And good afternoon. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Frank Pomeroy. I am the police chief in the city of Winona, Minnesota. And I also am here to be a proponent and speak in favor of the Fischbach bill. I, too, have been here for the last 3 years, and I testified last year when this bill moved through this committee. In my 22 years as a police chief in the city of Winona, the traffic management tool or the administrative fines have proven to be very effective. And I say that because it gave us an ability to deal with those people who might make a simple mistake. They might not be watching the speedometer and move to 6 or 7 miles above the limit. Yet that speed jeopardizes people's safety. And we are, in fact, in the business of representing people and ensuring their public safety. One of the examples that I like to use is that in the city of Winona, we have been administering these fines for approximately 5 years. We have taken the accident number in our city from between 1,250 and 1,450 a year down to between 850 and 950 a year, which is a reduction of almost 30%. The reason for that is because when people move between 5 and 10 miles above the limit, which they feel that they have a right to do, they move into intersections in a hurry. And instead of hitting the brake, they tend to hit the accelerator, and that causes crashes. You know, I heard that the insurance industry might be opposed to a bill like this. Let me tell you that if you take about $2,000 per car per accident, which is the minimum, and we can prevent 300 accidents a year, that's $1.6 million that the insurance industry isn't going to have to pay out in our city. The administrative fine bill makes sense. It treats people on very minimal offenses in a fair and equitable fashion. It gives law enforcement executives a tool where they can in fact, protect the public, and that is what we are entrusted to do. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that's available to testify?
Just pull up a chair. Okay, I'll be quick. Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
My
Gillespie.
Name is Bill Gillespie, and I'm the executive director.
Please close to the microphone, Mr. Gillespie.
Oh, okay.
Grab a chair. There you go. Makes more sense.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We've appeared here a number of times before. You've heard all the arguments on both sides. And frankly, I just came in. I don't think I picked up any votes from the last time. So I'm assuming that we're going to get beat up here. So I would just simply ask you to take into consideration The fact that we have not been able to resolve most of the issues that are in, that are contentious in this issue, and I don't know how much longer it will take to do that, but I would ask that you not pass this bill out today. Give us an opportunity to continue to meet and talk about it. Absent that, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association remains opposed to the passing of admin fines.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Anyone else who would like to testify from the public?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Gillespie, unless I'm sorry I didn't hear the original part of the testimony, but is part of your opposition that we would have vehicles that had committed similar offenses on the same road getting different penalties depending upon who actually did the stopping for the offense? Is that part of your concern?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, absolutely. In fact, I can give you one incident that was just recently relayed to me in the city of Hibbing. Police officer gave somebody who had clocked them at 72 in a 50, gave them a opportunity to take a administrative fine at 60 miles an hour and therefore avoid having to go to court and having to pay all the surcharges. So it obviously is going to be used and will be used in the future for speeding offenses, speeding offenses well in excess of 10 miles over the speed limit.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Gillespie, that would
Senator Scoy.
Part of that would be my concern with this bill also.
We have another testifier coming at 2 o'clock, and which we're a little ahead of schedule for this particular bill. But
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to address. My understanding is that a fiscal note was passed out for the bill,
yes.
And this fiscal note that dated 03-2707 is actually incorrect with the delete all amendment, the A1 amendment that we put on there. The amendment addresses the masking issue, which would deal with the federal funds. So we have addressed that by not allowing administrative fines to be issued to holders of commercial driver's license. So this loss of federal funds, any of the federal issue on federal dollars on here would be eliminated. That would not be an issue at all. That wouldn't. So the fiscal note that we're looking at is incorrect.
Is there going to be a new fiscal note then? Is that
Mr. Chair, that's up to the committee.
After it's okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, thought triggered from Mr. Gillespie sharing that experience of negotiating down to the 10-mile limit. Obviously, they know about that. Are there any consequences if an officer weren't to follow the limits that are allowable within this law? Are there any consequences to it? Or because Mr. Gillespie is claiming that that's the kind of practice that would then be happening. I would think our officers would have enough integrity to obey a law and not abuse it, that we've got some bigger problems here than maybe we're addressing even with this issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think that the sheriff
Senator
and
Fischbach.
The chief would like to answer that question.
Mr. Chair,
Sheriff.
Members of the committee, there are no hard and fast consequences if an officer on the street would drop a fine down a few miles per hour. We do grant very broad discretion in those officers in deciding how best to handle it. I know right now that occurs on a daily basis, and in fact for the past 30 years The State Patrol themselves have very routinely dropped a few miles an hour if somebody didn't have a particularly gross violation to allow the Dimler Amendment to kick in, an administrative system the state's been using for 30 years. So there are no hard and fast consequences. Certainly, we as chief law enforcement officers set a standard and expectations for those officers. If we're made aware that they're not following them, we can deal with that administratively.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson.
Mr. Gillespie.
How would you know? Nobody's tracking these administrative fines. Nobody reports them. Nobody knows who issues them. Nobody knows what they're doing with the money. So how would you ever know?
Well, Mr. Chairman, how did you know this happened up in Hibbing?
A deputy.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, a deputy sheriff who is on our board, his daughter received the administrative fine and relayed it to me in an email.
Mr. Chair, the chief wanted to say a few words on that issue.
Now, Chair and members of the committee, obviously as chief law enforcement officers, we policize different things that happen in our department. We've been utilizing the administrative fines for 5 years. We do track them. And in a matter of fact, if a person receives an administrative fine on the first occasion, they're less likely to receive something like that on a second occasion. It really is meant to be that stimulus that we need to make people change their driving behavior. And it works, and it works very well. The only tool we had in our hands prior to the administrative fines were verbal and written warnings. There are some people that would adhere by those, but there are many that don't. Many say, I got away with it once, I can do it again. We continually, prior to the administrative fine implementation, received complaints from neighborhoods where there were daycare centers, a lot of traffic in the street, pedestrian traffic, school zones, neighborhoods, where traffic was a problem. Those have ceased for the most part because we now have an effective tool to manage that traffic enforcement in those neighborhoods.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, sir, okay, this is already in place. Now, what is your bill doing that's different?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. Yes,
Senator Fischbein.
Yes, some of the municipalities and counties are using administrative fines, but there has been some concern. There's been what you would call a gray area in the statutes, and this would make it very clear that they are able to use those.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Senator Moy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the fact of the matter is that under current law, these local governments cannot impose this administrative fine. Current law says that they can't do that. And the local governments that have been imposing these administrative fines, according to an opinion by the Attorney General's office, as well as according to the State Auditor's office, who have done a study on this issue, have come back and said that if you look at current law and what's squarely within the state's jurisdiction, moving traffic violation of this nature, for which administrative penalties have been written at the local level, violates current statute. So what this bill is trying to do is to put into statute the permission for local governments to do exactly what they have been doing all along that they cannot do. So what we will do if this passes, we are creating new policy to allow local governments to administer traffic law, which is an area of jurisdiction that really ought to fall under state law for the sake of uniformity of application of laws all across the different jurisdiction. And I think that we had this conversation in the Judiciary Committee when we considered Senator Foley's bill, which didn't pass, by the way, because local government made a compelling argument that they needed the money from the administrative fines to do what they need to do. But this is the point that I made in the Judiciary Committee, and it is a point that certainly as policymakers in this committee, which is both policy and budget, understanding the fiscal impact, but as the Transportation Committee, having jurisdiction over transportation law in this state, there is a danger here that if we allow local governments and municipalities to go down the route of administering traffic violations independently in each of those local governments, that we have the potential here to create opportunities for disparate application of the law in different jurisdictions. So I think that the compelling argument for keeping current law and for not allowing this to happen is that forward-looking, if we care about some uniformity, I'm not saying uniformity of application of the law, because obviously there's a tremendous amount of latitude about how our law enforcement interact with our citizens. But as policymakers, we ought to at least set as broad an opportunity for uniformity of public policy at the state level. And if there ought to be differences or disparate application of it, I mean, that obviously, we can't do anything about that because we're not going to be out there regulating how people implement the law. But the argument, the core issue at discussion here is, if we go down this route, we're creating an opportunity for different local government, different municipalities to come up with different zoning and administrative policies at the local level, giving up an area of the law that is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the state, but then creating varying different standards for application of these traffic violations at the local level. So,
Mr. Chairman.
We have a question from Senator Scoy and then Senator Olson.
Can I just respond to this?
Okay. Senator Scoy defers to Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate what you're saying, but I think that it's kind of, what is it, the old Pogo saying, that we've met the enemy and he is us? You made the point that it's the local governments need the money, but the reality was that the state needed the money, and part of what's aggravated this is that we loaded it with surcharges that some of these officers feel very guilty, if you will, of imposing the kind of penalties that are really seem to be unjust because of the surcharges. Now, we had this discussion last year, and while we had a little surplus and might have lifted some of that, we didn't do that. And I think we ought to be looking at that again. If we would clean up our act, we probably wouldn't have this kind of pressure before us and the temptation to do something that that you believe is essentially illegal.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, Senate File 2644, which will be in front of you momentarily, will give all of us an opportunity to do that.
Okay. We have a testifier ready here
Mr.
from
Chair?
The state auditor.
Mr. Chair.
Who's calling?
With all due
Senator
respect,
Ortman.
Thank you. With all due respect to Senator Moi, we did have this conversation in the Judiciary Committee, and the fact is that what we do around here all day long is we change policy and we change current law. That is what we do. We come to the Capitol to look at our laws and our policies and say, do they need to be changed? And in the Judiciary Committee, we did not support Senator Foley's version of this bill. We supported Senator Fischbach's version of this bill. And the reason why is because we think that at least in that committee, the thinking was that the cities and the counties could be trusted with this authority. And we do that around here all day long, every day in session. We decide what we can trust cities and counties with and what we can't. We make those decisions, and this is a good decision, and it's not the first time we've made this decision. This bill passed in the House and in the Senate last year, and it passed again in the Judiciary Committee, and that is because collectively we have decided that these officers can be trusted with this authority. And because we passed them through the House and the Senate, I think that we created really a reasonable expectation that this kind of conduct was going to be okay with the state of Minnesota. And so they continued. It wasn't to be in violation of the law. It was because they believed that they had legislative support for their conduct. And so I think we should continue with that. I don't think we should pull that back now and change our mind a year later just because we can. I think, yes, let's look at the policy and make sure it fits. But I think that this is perfectly appropriate. I think changing the law to reflect the reasonable conduct of these law enforcement agencies is perfectly appropriate and within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee as it's acted and within this Transportation Committee.
And Mr. Chair, building on Senator Ortman, what
Senator Ortman
just said, we voted on this and passed this exact language out of this committee last year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear from the state auditor right now. She's prepared, she needs to leave.
Well, she's coming up.
questions coming up.
Okay, Senator Scoia has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I have a comment back to Senator Ortman. This doesn't have anything to do with whether we trust these officers or not. This has to do with whether Minnesotans on the road are getting equal treatment no matter where they are, and that it's fair for everybody. And the other thing, while this sheriff or chief of police might be tracking in his jurisdiction, those people are driving outside of that jurisdiction, and there's no way to know statewide what has occurred within that small jurisdiction. So this really is, you know, and you're right, we do change and make policies all the time, but we want to make sure that when we're done with them that they're fair and people are being treated uniformly across the state.
Mr. Chair.
Now you can go to the state auditor.
Okay, we're going to go to the state auditor now.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to Senator Scoia's comment,
briefly.
Which I think is appropriate. He has said that people are being treated without uniformity. I would say that's current. That's true under the current practices, because you've got some state agencies that will issue the ticket with all the charges, and then you've got some cities that won't stop anybody and some state troopers that won't stop them because they know that they can't be afforded in that community. So you've got disparate treatment right now. There's hardly uniformity in the way these tickets are being charged out now.
Thank you. Now we'll have the state auditor, Rebecca Otto.
Thank you,
please
Mr.
state
Chair.
Your name.
State Auditor Rebecca Otto, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm delighted to be here, and sorry I have another committee to go to in just a moment, but I wanted to briefly bring to your attention the report, which I think all of you have in your hands at this point. I don't know if any of you had a chance to read the whole thing. I wanted to highlight some of the highlights of it. I think this is an incredibly important discussion for lawmakers to be having right now, and Senator Mua and Senator Foley had requested we do this special study, which we were happy to do, because it's an issue we see within our office. I want you to know the nature of it. It was a voluntary survey. We could not force local governments to answer. We sent out 900 surveys, and we had about 248 responses. So that's, and of those 248 responses, 82% were cities and 17% were counties. So we had more cities responding than counties, although there's more cities than counties. I wanted to also bring to your attention, we have, you know, there wasn't really a definition of administrative penalties, but we tried to put something together on page 5. These penalty programs enforce local ordinances through an administrative system that is separate and distinct from the court system. The Minnesota Attorney General describes these procedures as intended to provide informal, cost-effective, and expeditious alternatives to traditional prosecutions for certain minor violations. Beyond these basics, administrative penalty programs are difficult to define or describe because the programs vary among local government entities. And they are used for traffic law violations. Our report looked at both quality of life and traffic law violations, but I think today you're probably focusing more on traffic law. And I'm going to take you then. We try to make our reports easy for you all. We have an executive summary. It's on in my report, it's blue. But kind of the highlights of the report are that some local governments have implemented these programs to enforce traffic laws. Although differences exist in their operation, there are some common characteristics of these programs right now. Right now, all the revenue collected is retained by the local government. The monetary fines are often less than the fines associated with state traffic tickets. Administrative penalties are not reported to other government entities and do not affect an individual's driving record or insurance. Administrative penalty programs are described as voluntary because violators have the option of accepting a state traffic ticket. Okay? We also wanted to get at why they were doing it, and we got a variety of answers. The highlights, again, or kind of the common themes were there's a belief that the distribution of the fine revenues from the state traffic ticket between state and local entities is inequitable. We heard that many times. We heard the need to generate revenue to replace LGA. That wasn't the most common, but that was one that we saw more than once. The need to decrease court congestion was common. The desire to increase enforcement by giving law enforcement a cost-effective alternative to state traffic tickets. And another common theme, desire to lessen the burden for the cited individuals. There's been a question about revenue and do administrative penalty programs, do they provide a significant source of revenue for these local government entities? And what we found was no, it does not. If you look at the amount compared to, for the ones that reported to us, if you look at the amount they were generating versus their total general revenues, it was less than 1%. It was not significant. If you looked at it in terms of a specific fund, let's say a public safety fund, it could be considered significant. And what we found was 12 of the 30 local governments that with administrative penalty programs for traffic law violations, about 40%, state that they designate the revenue for specific purposes. The most commonly designated fund or stated purpose for the revenue associated with these penalty programs for traffic law violations is to support law enforcement programs. Okay? I want to draw your attention to page 9. There's a bar graph there, and it shows the again, remember our sample size. It's not really large, but I think it's big enough to give you a sense, and I think this is probably true of the trend that's occurring. After the cuts in LGA in 2003, there's other respondents. There were 10 that had programs. In 2004, there were zero. The AG had issued an opinion, and our office also did something, I think, in early 2005. And so the numbers had gone down. But if you watch from 2005 to 2006 to 2007, they climbed back up. And I can tell you that we are keeping track of press clippings, and this is only going to be on the increase, not on the decline. More and more entities are looking at implementing these programs. What I also want to say to you all is that I think it's a very complicated issue. I think it's a really important issue because clarification would be very, I believe, very beneficial right now. Our office provides oversight of local government entities and making sure they're following the rules. And without further clarification, I'm afraid that this is going to continue. And so some form of clarification would be important. I'm not advocating for what that should be. In this report, I want you to realize that we have a summation. Someone asked in another committee, do we know how they're tracking this data? And if you go to Table 4 and page 11, we have, first of all, we have the type of violations, and there's a whole summary of the type of violations, traffic law violations covered by administrative penalty programs. It's a compilation from our survey. And it's anywhere from speeding 10 miles per hour over the speed limit and under, there's seatbelt restraint, no proof of insurance, all kinds of different things that are being that they're issuing tickets for right now, or these citations, I mean. And on page 12, there's another table that I think is helpful. Records and repeat violations. Some of you wanted to know what happens with that. Are you tracking that? 25 of the entities that responded are administrative penalties for traffic law violations recorded and tracked for individuals receiving tickets. 25 said yes, 4 said no, and 1 didn't answer. If yes, what department and positions maintain these records? Most of them, it was the law enforcement department. Okay. Is there a penalty for individuals for exceeding a certain number of administrative penalties for traffic law violations? 9 said yes, 19 said no, 2 no answers. And then we checked, is there a time limit? So there's a lot of really good information in this report to bring to your attention. In our office, right now in statute, there's no enforcement mechanism around this issue. So our office doesn't put anybody in jail, and we don't take away LGA. We don't do anything to them. All we do is they can get a finding in their audit. They get a comment in their audit. So that's one of the things that happens. But we would like to see, for I think everybody's benefit, is to hopefully have you guys dig into this issue and provide some clarification so that we're all working from the same page and we're all following the rules. So any questions?
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and State Auditor Otto. I missed part of what you said, but I understand there when I was coming in you were saying that this is caused by reductions in LGA. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Okay, so when we did our survey.
Auditor Otto.
If you go to the, I've got a nice little executive summary for you at the beginning, right after the table of contents, and there were five themes as to why they say they are doing these programs. One of them was LGA. That was only one. Some of them believe that the current distribution of the state ticket, the revenues, is not equitable or not adequate. They get a very, very small portion, and they say they do a lot of the work. Law enforcement didn't like it because the state fines are so high, and they were saying, this is one that I've heard, they weren't comfortable giving tickets with the surcharges as high as they were. Decreased court congestion. The LGA piece, they did lose revenues, and I think there's frustration over them trying to do the work, and yet they felt as though they weren't getting adequate revenues to do the work, and I think everyone knows, you know, they have tight budgets. So, but we found that it was not a significant form of revenue if you looked at the amount they're taking in versus their general revenues or overall general revenues. Does that answer your question, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chair. And
Senator Scott.
What I was hoping is that the and Senator Olson and I have been talking about it earlier today, that the Senate does have a provision to increase LGA by $90 million, and hopefully that would alleviate some of the financial concerns for these communities.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, and members, if you have time, and I know you're very, very busy people, in here we have actual case studies we've highlighted with their exact responses, and we have some news clippings to get at. We try to pick some that got at kind of what's going on and when they have open conversations about this issue. I would say that that the state surcharge, you know, the state ticket is burdensome in some communities, and what I've heard directly from law enforcement is that when you're in a community and you have a single mother who has four children and you know that a state ticket is going to throw her over the edge, there is a hesitancy, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just telling you some of the things that I've heard and what we heard, that it's a real concern. And so I think that, again, this is very multi-layered. There's LGA, there's court congestion, there is the state surcharge on state tickets. Does that make sense? It's complex.
Senator Cook.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Scoia, I would just say my local unit of government actually puts the money and uses it for a safe driving class. So you basically are paying for your enrollment in that class, and all the money goes to pay the costs for that class. So it doesn't go towards LGA. It goes towards the instruction. And I was able to read they do a survey as they come out, and a lot of folks talked about how they went in so angry that they had to take this. They didn't have to take the class, of course. It's optional. They can also take the state fine, but they kind of did it begrudgingly and were upset, and then they were all so excited about the results, and one woman suggested that her husband would benefit, and could he take the class? So that's where our money, where that money is going towards.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if Auditor Otto can answer this, but something in the executive summary did trigger a question in my head, so maybe someone at the table can answer, or counsel can answer. I was interested, now I lost it, but I was interested to see that an individual could opt for a state ticket. How does that happen? I mean, in practice, does the officer writing the ticket say, I can give you this ticket or this ticket? And someone says,
yes.
This one's a lot more money and this one's a lot less.
Mr. Chair, Member Senator Dibble, from what we have heard, you have to have due process. And so if somebody says they want to contest, some local governments have set up, you know, ways to have hearings, which I think believe that you all took away in statute some years ago to have the ability to have local, these boards to hear. Some were doing it with city council. Some were looking for retired judges. But some of them said, okay, if you don't want to pay the fine and you don't want to take this, then you can pay this one. You know what I mean? And they just then they can go through the courts and get their due process in there, and they can contest it. So I think that was something we saw in the programs was how they were handling that issue.
Mr. Chair, I think it might be, Mr. Chair, Senator it might Fishbach. Be helpful to have the sheriff answer how they handle that there, too.
Thank you. Sheriff, could you state your name again and spell it for me, please.
Sheriff Mickle, M-I-C-H-E-L, Wetzel, W-E-T-Z-E-L. Mr. Chair, Senator, most programs I know of, certainly the one in Morrison County, tells the people right on the citation as well as verbally that they do have a right to contest the citation through an administrative hearing officer. Or if they'd rather, they could opt out and they could request that the citation be reissued as a state citation, which would give them full access to the court system. Since 2003, we have had no hearings, period.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, I'm curious to tell you, does the offender have to pay the ticket on the spot? I'm thinking about, you know, it's one thing for people who live in the jurisdiction there in your locality, but if they're coming from, you say, my neck of the woods, and they drive through, they're going to their cabin or whatever, and they get pulled over, how does that work, and you know, how do you make sure that they're going to pay that fine?
Sheriff Wetzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, most jurisdictions that I know of handle them this way. Certainly we do. The citation is given to them. It has an envelope with it. They can drop the money in and send it directly to the city or the county, whoever issued it. We don't allow our officers to accept the money on the street. We want it to go through an accounting process, which our county auditor has worked out through the state auditor's office, that they found to be very effective in ensuring accountability, that every one of those tickets resulted in either the money being receipted properly to the county or it resulted in a state citation being issued.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Sheriff Wetzel,
Senator,
then
Senator
if they, let's say, you know, there are people who don't pay their tickets, I mean, how do you track those people down? I mean, do you have to send out a sheriff or a deputy from the county to go find out, or is there a state-issued citation of some sort that gets the collection done, or how does that work?
Sheriff Wetzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, anytime we write them a ticket, we take the same information that we would for a state ticket. So if they fail to pay the administrative tag within the time period allotted, we then void that and reissue a state ticket and send it out through the U.S. mail.
Okay. And one final question, if I might,
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and Sheriff Wetzel, on the, in your practice, do people from that are from outside of your area, do they tend to get just the state-issued ticket, or how do you make that determination that this qualifies for administrative fine instead of the state-issued ticket?
Sheriff Wetzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we pay no attention whatsoever to where they're from. It makes no difference to us at all. We base that decision solely on their driving conduct, on the nature of the violation. Very generally, speed violations that are minor in nature, approximately 10 miles an hour over, we would opt for the administrative citation unless there was some other aggravating factor. If they have a horrible record of appearing in court or something like that, we may opt initially for the state. But routinely, the administrative would be appropriate for a low-level violation without regard for where they live.
Okay. Thank you.
Sheriff Wetzel, I have a question about how do you keep track of these violations? And then do you share those violations with anyone? And do you have a city that's within your county that is also doing the same thing? And do you share that information?
Mr. Chair, we do track them. We have a records management system like all law enforcement agencies do, and we are the primary dispatch center for our county. So not only our deputies, but any city police officer or state trooper in Morrison County using our frequency can simply ask to query our records to determine whether they've received an administrative citation before. Very routinely, if they receive one, they won't get another one. And there was a first part, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Question was whether you share the information with cities, and are there any cities that have their own systems also?
We do share the information by means of queryability. They can query our records management system whenever they want on the air or in the office, and all of them do. So we don't exchange written information. It's all on our records management system, which they have access to.
And I guess to clarify the question, so any cities that are within your county are using your system for databasing?
Our system, the Little Falls Police Department has their own. They will be linked shortly, but all of the smaller police departments actually use our records management, and even the Little Falls Police Department dispatches through us. So they can query our system even though they're not directly online with it.
Okay. And do other counties query your system?
I'm not aware of that, Chairman.
Okay. I guess Ms. Otto has to go to another appointment. Is there any more questions of the committee from Ms. Otto? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for looking at this issue and considering it. And if you have any further questions, we'll certainly try to help you. Oh, is there one more?
I do. You know, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I'm sorry to detain you. I did have one last question that just popped into my head. I had it before, but now I just remembered it. Auditor Otto, did I hear you correctly that you talked about the fact that there had been 10 and then dropped to 0 and then it's climbed back up? So the folks who have gone back to using administrative penalties, do I understand correctly they're doing this outside of the law or the opinion of the Attorney General, or are they finding some sliver of statute that makes them think they can do this? And did you say that cities that are doing that have a finding in their audit that says you're doing this and you probably shouldn't be?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, and members, I don't have one of my attorneys with me, but what we did say in here is, I'll just read this to you briefly if this helps you. The legal status of administrative penalty programs for traffic law violations differs from the status of quality of life, okay? In at least one significant way, administrative penalty programs for traffic law violations have been expressly preempted by state law. Okay? So it's been preempted. And it says in 03, the AG concluded that with the enactment of Minnesota Statute Chapter 169, the state had preempted the field of certain traffic laws. The Minnesota AG relied on the provision outlined in Minnesota Statute 169.022, which stipulates a uniform application of traffic rules and regulations. And it continues to go on. In addition, Section 169.9 requires the use of a uniform traffic ticket for the enforcement of traffic laws throughout Minnesota. Now, I did say clarification would be helpful because I think there's been bills that said absolutely no, you cannot, so that it makes it very crystal clear because sometimes people feel there's an ambiguity. We did in our survey ask, what do you feel is your statutory authority to do this? And there really wasn't a whole lot. I will say that I think some local governments feel as though they've stumbled upon a very good thing, and they think they've got something good going in their community, and they have explanations as to why they think this may be better for the courts, and it may be better for public safety within their communities. Again, that's why I think it's so complex. Now, I hope that I have answered all your questions.
Yes, you have. I did want one follow-up. Is the story a little different for the quality of life tags?
Ms. Otto.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, and members, the quality of life one is a little bit more difficult. We had our legal staff really digging into this, and some people pulled some hair out because it can differ with that. Some of them, they can do certain quality of life things. And so what we did was I think Senator Moisa, could you just let us know kind of what's going on there? And so we listed some of the things they're doing for quality of life. Mm-hmm. Are there some things that maybe go above and beyond what is in statute? It could be. Mm-hmm. But, there are some things they can do, and it depends on if they're statutory or charter and all kinds of things. So.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the chair would like to address that, too, because it is the gray area.
Okay. Will this require a response from Ms. Otto?
All right. I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Otto. Sheriff Wetzel.
Mr. Chair, no disrespect at all meant to the senator, but we disagree that it violates state law. I wouldn't do something that I believe violates state law. Now, we have an opinion from the auditor's office. We have an advisory opinion from the Attorney General, which is non-binding. Attorneys argue all the time. In fact, I don't have a Juris Doctor, but I'm an educated man who reads and writes English quite well, and I don't believe we're in violation of the law, and I can name probably 24 city and county attorneys who very much disagree with the interpretation of the State Attorney General's staff who issued that opinion. So that's why we're here. We're asking you to fix it. We have county attorneys and city attorneys who very firmly believe we are within the law right now. But there's enough discussion and enough debate that we keep coming back here hoping you'll settle the debate.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
You know, Mr. Chair, I've always said that, and I admit it publicly, that English is my second language. And at times, I may have difficulty interpreting language or statute. But I think that the law is clear to say that where state law has preempt. And I think that that's what the auditor's report just said, is that I think when it comes to traffic violations, state law has preemption. And preemption in respect of the area of seatbelt restraint and the area of child restraint, there might be some gray areas and some penalties having to do with speeding or maybe, you know, ditch driving or obstructing driver's view or tinting your window. There might be some gray areas. But I really don't know how seatbelt restriction violations or child restraint violations, which have come up time and again in this committee for us to deal with the specific statutory provisions to govern those areas, I don't know how there's a gray area. And where state law is preempted, local government cannot be regulating. I don't think that there is a difference of opinion. If the argument here is that there might be some administrative fines in some areas, that is great. Reasonable people can differ in that, and I hear that, and I understand in some of these things. But when it comes to something that is as clear as seatbelt restraint or child restraint, I just don't know. And even if English is my second language, I don't know how you could say that that's a gray area.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gillespie's been waiting to speak here for quite some time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just hopefully will speak on three issues for the last time in my life. I just want to clear up a couple points. One, it was offered earlier that this bill or this language passed the House and the Senate. Actually, it didn't, or otherwise we wouldn't be here. It would be law, and it would be over with. There's obviously still quite a bit of contention about it. Senator Moi touched on what I think is the touchstone of the argument, of the discussion, and that is the uniformity of application. And that uniformity of application has to do not only with enforcement, but it has to do with the fine schedule, the fees and the surcharges. If the fees and the surcharges are onerous, which I certainly believe they are because I don't think it's built upon an ability to pay, I think it's the most regressive tax, that you could possibly offer. But that should be dealt in another arena, in another discussion. The uniformity of application also has to do with tracking. There is only one way to track statewide application of the behavior of driving an automobile, and that's the tag on the upper right-hand corner of that uniform citation that has that connotation to it, uniform state Minnesota citation. That one allows engineers and traffic experts. That one allows the federal government reports to be made accurately. It allows the insurance companies to be able to make reasonable expectations of how they will be doing business and what they will charge their customers in this state. I don't believe that running off administrative tags on a copying machine in City Hall is going to offer you that kind of information to the state engineers and to the federal government and to the State Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation. There is only one instrument that does that, and that is the uniform citation with the tracking number up on top. And the last thing is this works. Uniform citation works. If its fees are onerous, take them away. We've testified on behalf of that. We think it was the original money that was proffered by the tags was supposed to be used for a dedicated fund for police training, to reimburse local units of government for police training. Over the years, we've managed to accumulate a number of other fees and surcharges that have nothing at all to do with reimbursing local units of government for police training. So if you want to remove that, there's another bill that will be up shortly. You're free to move that one on and send it into the debate. But what you're doing here is you're taking a system that works, and you're offering the possibility of mischief versus policy. There is no way to be able to track statewide or make uniform application with a system that checkerboards across the 800 and some cities of the state of Minnesota and the 87 counties. And with that, I really have nothing else to offer.
Thank you.
Mr.
Now, we have a person in the audience, I believe, Joan Kupchinski from the Department of Motor Vehicle Services.
Mr. Chair, I'd
yes.
just like to correct something
Senator Fischbach.
That Mr. Gillespie said, that yes, this, I can't remember if it was exactly this language, but similar language allowing for administrative fines did pass the Senate. I can't speak for the House. But last year as part of another bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator
Mr. Fischbach, Gillespie.
You're correct. It did pass the Senate.
And
it did not pass the House, but it was proffered that it passed the House and Senate, and that was not correct, or otherwise it would have been law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, the bill was vetoed. So
Senator Fischbach.
But I will stop.
Okay.
Wait, is there another person coming?
Yeah. Senator Dahl, yes.
On that point, then, I'd like to ask a question. I'm looking at, I think the last year's bill is probably at the back of this thing here. And there's a bill in the back here anyway. Same number, 169.022. I think this must have been from last year. And in the back section here, it has a subdivision 4 and a subdivision 5. that are not on your current bill. And one of it says that talks about administrative penalty may not exceed this maximum state fine, and talks about a holder of a commercial driver's license may not be issued a citation. I don't see that on this particular language.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Fischbein.
I can't find exactly what page you're on right off.
Page 79.
But what it was Senator Coring offered an amendment on the floor. So it wasn't the bill itself. It was an amendment. But I believe, and I'm sorry, repeat the page you were looking at.
Well, the actual language that I've been looking at is on page 81 of this packet that we've received. And it's on your current bill, you have a subdivision 2 and 3.
It's on the back.
But no 4 and 5.
It's on the back. Senator Dahl, it's on the back page of the amendment.
Is it? Oh,
yes.
On amendment. I
yes.
was looking at the wrong
on the
page.
Amendment.
And if that's
okay.
addressed, then
yes,
I'm
it's
excused.
Taken care of. And Ms. Kopchinski, I believe, I don't know if you have specific information, but there might be a couple of questions for you. So if you have something that you can offer here, we'd appreciate hearing it.
Mr. Chair, members, the department has remained neutral on this bill. However, keeping in mind that the federal penalties, which Senator Fischbach has explained to us, we have taken that into consideration. One of the things in working with the department for over 32 years is the integrity of the driving record. And what happens when tickets are not placed on driving records is creates the records aren't complete. We don't know if violations are occurring. We don't know if a violation occurs in Hennepin County or Ramsey County or Carver County if these administrative penalties are imposed. And so what happens is the integrity of the record is diminished by not knowing the true number of citations that have been issued to an individual.
And I guess my sole question on that is that when there are citations issued to a person, to a driver, and then they get a commercial driver's license where that information has not shown up, is that a negative to the integrity of that commercial driver's license? And is that something that we would have some kind of retroactive problem with?
Mr. Chair, members, it is considered masking. If an individual received an offense at the time they were not a commercial driver, and then for them to become a commercial driver, that offense, of course, would not be part of the history of the record, therefore, again, eroding the integrity of the driving record in whole.
Okay. Thank you. We are going to have to vote.
Mr. Chair, then I'll
yes.
move the bill. I was just going to make that motion. I would move that 1008, Senate File 1008 as amended.
As amended.
And I'm assuming it has to go to Judiciary Committee.
Going to Judiciary, yes.
And I would just say this will clear up if you know, there obviously, Mr. Chair, is some difference of opinion on whether or not we've handled these properly, and I think that Senate File 1008 will do that. It will make it very clear to the cities and counties what they can and cannot.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach moves Senate File 1008 to be referred to Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not pass.
Division.
Hands. All those in favor? All those opposed? It's a tie, and the motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
Senate File 2695, Senator Olsen. Just for your information, all the bills that we have not gotten to will be heard at 6:30 tonight when we reassemble. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm here today on Senate File 2695, and this has to do with transportation and access and implementation of some plans for bus transit that's already been done. So we have a couple testifiers, but I also have Joel Yulin, who is going to walk through the main parts of the bill.
Okay. And if you could be really fast, I'd appreciate it. We must be out of here at 2:45.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Yulin. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. It's also our lobby day today, so this is why we've got a number of people in the room today. I want to tell you that we've been working on this bill. There's also an A1 amendment that the committee will have before it as well. What this A1 amendment will do is it is a product of some of the discussions that we've had with the Department of Transportation and also in the Metropolitan Council. And trying to address this bill. What this bill does is that it requires planning for how to best meet the transit needs for people with disabilities and seniors into the future. There's a number of concerns that have been brought in recent years as we have seen some of the inequities and problems of transit for people with disabilities. And so the goal of this bill is to try to get some additional planning out there so that way we can know, especially as the new money now is going to become available in the upcoming years, how to best meet those needs into the future. I think one of the last points that I would say is that one of the things we've worked very hard to do is to make sure that this is treating both the rural areas and the metro areas equally in how we're trying to develop this issue. I have a testifier here, Barb Marsh, who can talk a little bit about her personal experience.
Thank you. Before you testify, Ms. Marsh, I'm going to make an announcement here that Senate File 2644 and 3027 from Senator Moi will be covered before we adjourn from this committee. The next committee in this room is Senator Moi's committee, so she's giving us the additional time. So anyone that is here for those two bills, please hang around. Okay, Ms. Marsh.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Barb Marsh, and I live in Chanhassen, Minnesota. I have multiple sclerosis, and I am here to in support of Senate File 2695 to provide better planning for how transit services can better meet the needs of people with disabilities like me. I enjoy being in my community, and I lead a support group as well as volunteer with the Carver Scott Humane Society, and would like to participate in my church and other functions in the community. However, I was not able to do this anymore because of funding being cut back, and now I have no service in the evenings. Since the transit services were cut in the evenings a few years ago, it has been almost impossible for me to leave my support group. And it has put me in the situation where at times I have gone someplace and have not been able to get home, and have had, luckily through the grace of God, been able to find someone that could transport me back home. The bill before you asked the Metropolitan Council to plan for the needs of people with disabilities. As someone who lives in the suburbs, I see and need the need for this planning. I know of more housing that is being built for the people with disability in my area, but the transit options are not always available. This has to be better coordinated. I am also concerned that the governor's budget makes significant cuts to transit services in the metro area. The last time this happened, my evening transit services were taken away, as I told you before. This makes me wonder what is next and how am I supposed to plan my life when my transit options are so unpredictable. I would ask you to support Senate File 2695 and oppose the governor's proposed budget cuts to transit. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we also have Michelle Lyon, who would also like to address the committee.
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Michelle Lyon from Southwestern Center for Independent Living, and I'm here to speak to you today just about my personal experience and other knowledge that I have of our transit issues in southwestern Minnesota. I live in Marshall, Minnesota, which is a town of about 12,000 people, and that's equal to about half the total population in Lyon County. I rely on public transit daily as I go back and forth between two jobs and various meetings and volunteer opportunities. I used to work a morning shift that began a half an hour before public transit was available. In order to get to that shift, I asked a friend, and that worked for a while, but it was a temporary solution. And so eventually, I had to give up that shift. Thankfully, there was a later shift by then that had opened up, and I was able to then use public transit to keep my job. But even now, I work a Saturday shift that ends after public transit is available in the evenings. I typically get done around 6:45 in the evening, and I have to rely on either friends or coworkers to get me home from work. And if someone is not available to get me home from work, it's relatively typical in the summer anyway to see me push the mile and a half from work back to my apartment. But my story, I'm one of the lucky ones. I've talked to many, many others through my position at the Center for Independent Living who are not as lucky. They don't work simply for lack of transportation. Also, I'm a member of the Marshall Area Transit Committee, and we meet regularly to discuss our local transit issues. There's a lot of details in my testimony that I'm going to skip over for in the interest of time, but I will tell you that our 2007 trip statistics in Lyon County show that 82% of our trips in Lyon County are in the city of Marshall, which leaves only 18% of the total trips for the smaller towns within the county. So as you can see, transit, when you're not in a county seat in a smaller area, is very, very limited. Another issue we encounter is policy issues that exist between human service agencies, managed care providers, and transit programs regarding interpretation of client rights when accessing services. Because there are multiple funding options available for different riders, we see that duplication occurs because people are not working together. This must be eliminated. This issue compounds itself in greater Minnesota, in the rural areas. Along with my testimony, there's been other statistics from Western Community Action attached, so you can see some of the other numbers and services that they provide in other counties outside of Lyon County. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
If I may, I'd like to move the A1 amendment to place this in the form I'd like it to go in.
Senator Olsen moves the A1 amendment to Senate file number 2695. Any discussion? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Same sign. The amendment is adopted. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By moving the A1 amendment, it addresses some current concerns that MnDOT had about implementation of the study, and because they need to report on an annual basis. So we moved it to struck January and added February to give them time to accumulate the previous year's data. And then the effective date is August 1st, 2009. So that means that their first report would have to be in 2010. So that they should be comfortable with the leeway that gives them to start doing their reports on this. And then that's basically what this bill is about, is there was a 2001 study done about transit, and so this is kind of saying, now let's see the plan to implement it. So they're allowed to use the 2001 information. The heart of the bill is figuring out a way to implement the plan.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olsen, thank you for bringing this bill forward. In my district, it crosses the river, so half of the district is covered by Metropolitan Council and Metro Mobility. And the south end, it's covered by the opt-out group, DARTS. And what I'm told by my constituents is that the program south of the river works a whole lot better the north of the river, and they think that a lot of it has to do with the Met Council not really making this a priority. So by having a plan, I hope that they're able to address the needs of our community and the folks that are disabled and need that service critically. So I'll thank you for bringing this forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl,
Senator
Subdivision
Rossi.
4 is really designed for Met Council to address those exact issues that you were just mentioning.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I do hope this does work. Listening to Senator Dahl brings back an experience I was involved in very heavily through the entire interim with Met Council changing. They have some transportation services within the Met Council and then Metro Transit. And I think they abandon a philosophy that was that precious word in here called service, and have now implemented what I consider managing a fleet of vehicles by a set of rules. And to me, that's a little different than delivering service. And what's happened is that I've got a growing roster of complaints for service ignored or not delivered well because they've kind of lost sight that there is a real need out there and have concentrated more on what might enhance their overall transit system. And I don't think it's working. Now, I don't know if this will move them in the direction that I think is there's a growing need for, not just in terms of disability, but as people are aging, they have different needs, and they'd like to be able to stay in their homes, and they may not have access to to their own private transportation. And I think we need to have some good planning. So I hope this works.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, I think one word in there makes a big difference, and that's the word implement. And so it is taking plans and putting them into action, and with the goal of addressing 80% of the unmet transit needs across the state by 2015, and I think a pretty generous goal of going to 90% by 2025. So there should be plenty of time to implement this, and I think we had compelling testimony today about how important it is for people that can't drive on their own, that need access to public transportation, and especially in rural parts of the state. It's a huge issue. And one of the upside about this is that $58 million over the next 10 years from the transportation bill going to outstate Minnesota goes a long ways. In the metropolitan area, $58 million seems to get eaten up pretty quickly, but in rural Minnesota, that money will do a lot of good things.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Day.
Well, first off, Senator, I like your bill, and but I tell everybody, and I'll repeat it again, we spent $800 million on a train from downtown Minneapolis to the Mall of America. $800 million. We could have had the best bus system in the world. Now what we're doing is we're going to funnel $909 million, and we're going to have a train from Minneapolis to St. Paul. And I will tell you that I hope people zero in and say, hey, you know what? Maybe we better go a little bit more on the buses in greater Minnesota and all over the state. Can come near your home. They can run fast express routes. They can run short routes. They can change with the demography as it changes in the state. And I keep mentioning, and I'm going to stay on it, because when you put down railroad tracks, you're pretty well limited to where you're headed, and somebody has to get to the railroad tracks to get on whatever is there to ride. So I'm going to keep mentioning it until I leave here.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day.
Senator Olson.
One of the recent articles in the paper that I read about the Central Corridor was that in the plan, when that train is implemented, they're going to still have to continue the buses. Instead of running every 20 minutes, they're going to run every half hour because the train can't serve all the needs along the corridor. And they're still going to run the express run because instead of taking – a lot of people don't want to spend 45 minutes between Minneapolis and St. Paul. They'd rather take the express bus from downtown Minneapolis to St. Paul on the freeway. So I haven't figured out yet what we're going to accomplish by that route either.
Okay, back on the bill here. Senator Olson, We have a potential amendment here. If you would like to author a verbal amendment Ms. Berezovsky read it off for you, and what it'll do is it will reflect what's in the fiscal note here. The fiscal note says that MnDOT does not require any additional funding, and the chart shows that the department, MnDOT, MnDOT does not need any funding also. So Ms. Berezovsky has an amendment which can, in effect, help us go right to the floor and not have to go to finance. So if you would like to author that, Ms. Berezovsky will read it off for you. First, Ms. Boyd will clarify the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The fiscal note, as it's, I just want to point out, first of all, that the fiscal note in front of you is on the House version of this bill, but with the A1 amendment, the language is now identical, so the fiscal note does stand as before you. What it reflects is a $250,000 required expenditure from MnDOT to implement or to develop and implement the plan, but there is no appropriation in the bill from any fund to MnDOT to accomplish this. It's just a cost that they expect to have to expend. Met Council's piece in the fiscal note says that there is no fiscal impact with this legislation, that it can be absorbed within the agency.
So now Ms. Berezovsky will read off the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, after line 2.32, insert section 4, creation of report and assessment. The Department of Transportation and Metropolitan Council shall create the reports and assessments required in this act within current appropriation levels.
It sounds good to me.
Any questions on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Are we ready to move the bill? Any questions? Senator Rolstein moves Senate File 2695. As amended, and it will be referred directly to the floor. Any further questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. It's passed. Thank you. We have two more bills from Senator Moi. Senate File 2987. I'm sorry, 2987 is Senator Murphy. We're going to lay that over till this evening.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to take up Senate File 2644 first.
Senator Mott.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 2644 seeks to address some of the very reasons that were offered to the state auditor as a rationale for the implementation of the administrative fines and penalties at the local level. So let me give the rationale to why I am bringing up this bill, and then I will briefly walk through the different sections of the bill for the members. Mr. Chair and members, throughout the past decade, there has been a sentiment that users of the civil and criminal justice systems should help pay for them. In other words, the court system should resemble more of a fee-for-service funding model than a general fund appropriations model. This is particularly true of the criminal justice system, where the users are criminals and the passage of onerous fees and surcharges can be justified as both punishment and reimbursement. An example is the Peace Officer Standard and Training, or POST Board, which receives 39% of the first $25 of the criminal and traffic surcharge. Of course, the criminal justice system, the police, the courts, and corrections is so large that fees and surcharges can recoup only a small fraction of the total cost of the system. In any case, unless a fee or a surcharge is statutorily dedicated, it flows to the general fund, not to a particular agency or service, leaving law enforcement, the courts, and corrections to go through the general fund appropriation process. Almost all fee and surcharge increases since 2003 have been deposited into the general fund in this manner. In 2003, the state was facing a $4.2 billion budget deficit. In response, all state agencies were forced to cut their budgets, and the legislature searched for ways to raise revenue.
Because of the number of fees and surcharges already present in the criminal and civil justice systems, the legislature created only one new fee and one new surcharge, but enhanced a dozen others. Raising existing fees and surcharges had added advantage that collection histories existed and a rough but approximate estimate of anticipated revenues could be made. So in the 2003 crime bill, raised judicial fees and surcharges by $86.6 million for the biennium, all of which was deposited in the general fund. At the same time, criminal justice-based funding for the biennium was cut by $98.2 million, which included a $14.8 million cut to the courts, a $25.7 million cut to the Department of Public Safety, and a $57.7 million cut to the Department of Corrections. The 2005 crime bill raised an additional $16.3 million in civil and criminal fees and surcharges, which were deposited in the general fund. Of course, these general fund cuts and fee and surcharge increases became part of the state's base budget, where they can remain today. A list of increased fees and surcharges are included in a document that's being passed out to you for your review. And in addition to the judicial fees and surcharges listed in that document, the legislature also increased the DWI driver's license reinstatement surcharge from $40 to $145, effective in 2002. And then effective on July 1, 2003, that $145 went up to $430. There are approximately 29,000 DWI license reinstatements each year. The increase from $40 to $430 brings in approximately $11.3 million annually. By increasing fees and surcharges, the legislature solved a short-term budget problem but created some unintended long-term consequences. Many argue that the increase in civil court fees has been so steep that it has essentially denied court access to lower-income citizens. Although this claim is anecdotal, it certainly seems plausible, as filing fees are collected prior to court action and cannot be waived. The 2003 crime bill raised 12 civil court fees, collecting an additional $43.3 million over the biennium. Another unintended consequence of the increase in criminal and traffic surcharges is the proliferation of administrative fine schedules by local units of government. As you know, we've heard in last bill testimony that many cities and counties are issuing local ordinance fines in lieu of uniform traffic citations. By doing this, they are retaining the entire fine locally, which currently the state received two-thirds of the fine, and the state surcharge of $72 goes uncollected. The increased local fine collection is not the only reason local governments are pursuing administrative fines. We know that. Many officials feel that the $72 surcharge on a traffic ticket is simply inequitable. This anecdotal evidence implies that at some point the increased traffic surcharge is counterproductive. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, there's the problem of noncompliance. This is particularly true of the DWI driver's license reinstatement surcharge, which has increased from $40 in 2002 to $430 today. When added to the $250 reinstatement fee, the total cost to regain one's license is $680. Many offenders simply prefer to drive without a license, which in turn creates more problems down the road, which results in further noncompliance, and there are thousands of outstanding warrants for driving without a license. So, Mr. Chair and members, I hope this information is useful, but please, please, if the least that we can do is to do something about this, then I ask you to support Senate File 2644. Senate File 2644 is, in essence, seeks to eliminate court fees and surcharges that were enacted in the 2003 legislative session. The fees reduced or eliminated include are the criminal offense surcharges, the DWI driver's license reinstatement fee, various court fees, and the public defender co-fee. So Section 1 of the bill reduces the DWI driver's license reinstatement surcharge from $430 to $50. Sections 2, 3, 6, and 7 reduce various fees related to the judiciary, including the appeal fee for small claims and tax cases and certain other filing fees.
Sections 4 and 5 lower the surcharge imposed on criminal and traffic offenders from 72 to 35 and eliminates the $4 surcharge for parking-related offenses. Section 8 eliminates the $28 public defender copay that's in current law. The only thing that we did that is remaining intact is the extra $40 increase in fee that we impose, and that goes directly to the traumatic brain injury program, which is something that we want to keep in place. And Mr. Chair and members, there's an amendment, the A2 amendment, I believe. When the bill was first drafted, the transportation bill had not become law. And in the transportation bill, we had a provision to allow people who are paying the DWI reinstatement fee to pay it in installment plans. Despite the reduction or the rollback of the fees to pre-2003, it is my intent to keep that installment payment plan in place. And so the A2 amendment attempts to do that. Even with the reduced fee back to what it was in pre-2003, we still allow people to make the installment payment plan. And Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Amendment has been in, motion has been made. Any comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to take any questions on the bill. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. In the document that is being passed out, if you were to take all these fees, look at the total number of the fees that have been imposed, I think that you can see clearly what we have, how onerous in terms of fees and surcharges we've imposed on the public. There's a fiscal note which comes in at a lower number that we had anticipated, but it is about a $60,000 hole.
Oh, 60.
So it's more than what we anticipated. So it's more, actually, I read that wrong. I guess it is a little bit more. It will leave a $120 million hole, which is, in my document that I passed out to you, I anticipated a $107 hole.
How do we handle that with the situation we have today?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to think that this committee is concerned about how onerous the fees and the surcharges are. As a matter of public policy, I think that it has been communicated by members of this committee as we've discussed the administrative fines and penalties, that there's huge concerns among members of this committee about how onerous we've made it for people to pay their traffic violations and traffic tickets. I think that it is appropriate for us to send a message to the Finance Committee that as a result of trying to identify resources for the Finance Committee's expenditure elsewhere outside of transportation, public safety, and the judiciary, we've imposed these onerous fines and surcharges and fees to people who least are able to afford it. And so I think that the hole that has created will be an interesting issue for the Finance Committee to look at and to think about. But from a public policy standpoint, I think it's appropriate for this committee to send the message that we think that it is unfair and that the onerous fees and surcharges are reaping unintended consequences, really pushing the burden onto local governments.
Is there any testimony either for or against?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Who spoke?
Senator
Ortman. Okay. Senator Ortman.
I'm sorry, it took me a while to find a chair as well. So I'm glad there's a chairman in this committee. And Senator Moore, a question for you. I'm looking at Section 1, Subdivision 2B. Are you really saying that you want to reduce the fines and surcharges of folks convicted of impaired driving, DWI, and criminal vehicular homicide?
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Senator Moore, I can understand that people that are paying routine traffic fines maybe shouldn't pay as much as they currently are. But if we're talking about criminal vehicular homicide, people that are convicted of that, the criminal sentence for that is up to 10 years imprisonment and a fine of not more than $20,000, I would think that we could easily remove them from this bill, and I would hope that you would consider that a friendly amendment, that we take out the reference to 609.21.
Well, one clarification, that these are not fines. These are reinstatement fees. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I think the proposal is to take out the surcharge, the $430 surcharge, and reduce the fees.
That's the driver's license reinstatement fee.
Right.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, they've been subject to a 10-year imprisonment penalty plus a $20,000 fine. I don't think the $430 is something that we should be that concerned about. I think that if they've been convicted of criminal vehicular homicide, maybe we don't want to cut them this break. And I would think that that would be an easy amendment here. I can't imagine that we derive that much of this revenue from people that have been convicted of criminal vehicular homicide.
Senator Dibble, you have a question.
No, you made my point, but Senator Ortman, could you just tell me exactly where you're looking, what page, so I can follow you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, Senator Ortman. Looking at the reference on page one of the bill,
okay.
Subdivision 2, paragraph B,
uh-huh.
which refers to section 169A.52, 169A.54, and 609.21. And when I look at 609.21, I see criminal vehicular homicide and injury.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Moy.
The core issue here is that we've made it very onerous for people who would like to reclaim their driver's license, to reclaim their driver's license. We passed a transportation bill that became law, which recognized that this $430 fee plus the surcharge was the $250 fee plus the surcharge was too onerous. And so this committee, even though those are bad people, recognize that they deserve a break and that we ought to allow them to make an installment payment. I don't know how the same committee that made a public policy decision to allow the same individuals an opportunity to make a payment plan is suddenly determining that they are a group that's not worthy of the same fee rollbacks and surcharge rollbacks that was taking all the rest of the other fees back to the pre-2003 era.
Any further
so, Mr.
questions?
Chair, if there is no further questions, I'd like to move the Senate File 26.
Senator Day.
Well, and she's thinking of moving the bill. I now have realized that she's actually serious. This is probably one of the more ridiculous bills we've ever had in the Transportation Committee. People are losing their homes. They don't have food. We're taxing them to do absolutely everything, and 29,000 people that get DWIs, we're now going to relieve them of $380 each. Vehicle, home. I mean, Senator, I can't even grasp what you're trying to do here. These are people that are breaking the law, and if it's myself or anybody else, I can't imagine with where we're at in Minnesota with almost a $1 billion deficit and people getting laid off and all these things that we're going to say, hey, you 29,000 people that went out there and broke the law, or hey, you other 50,000 people that broke the law, we're going to give you a deal because we're charging you too much. I don't understand that. That rationale is... I don't know.
Well,
but I'm not surprised because I've just observed that we got this bait and switch here of, you know what, people, we're going to relieve you of a few bucks, but in the meantime, we're going to tax you over here. And I don't get it. I honest to God, I'm having a hard time grasping what people are trying to do here. But
Mr. Chair and Senator Day, it's a pretty thick bill. It's about 9 pages of multiple fees and surcharges that have been added on. You're looking at only one, which we want to roll back.
There is a document that I've passed out that should be at your desk that shows you the various fees and surcharges that we've tacked on over time. So that should explain to you the multitude of other things that we're doing. This same committee just had a discussion less than half an hour ago saying that we're sympathetic and we're in essence going to support local law enforcement's ability to offer people relief because we've made fees and surcharges so onerous and excessive that we're in essence going to allow local government to write administrative tickets to alleviate individuals of that burden. I'm offering here an opportunity for us to be consistent in that effort to say, you know, let's not treat the symptom. Let's actually go directly to what the issue is, what the illness is. The illness is that we've made fees and surcharges so onerous that even law enforcement at the local level are willing to go the route of administrative fines and penalties to alleviate the courts and to alleviate citizens of how onerous we've made it for them. So what you focus on may be one. Maybe some people might think that it's ridiculous. I happen to think that this is, from a policy standpoint, this is a good direction to go. And Senator Day, I have tremendous respect for you. You're a man with honor, and you represent your constituents well. Any senator who has a good idea who brings it forward, I think that it ought to be considered in that light. And you may think that this proposal is ridiculous. I happen to think that it is being responsible and responsive to the citizens for whom we've made our judiciary literally inaccessible because they can't afford it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, people with DWIs that are out killing people driving around at night. And I will tell you, if they get a DWI, I see no reason in the world that I, as a state senator, have to say, we're going... What really drives people is how much it costs, and we have to get it across to people that if you do these different things, it is going to cost you high insurance, high a whole host of things, going to court and the whole nine yards. And I will tell you, I personally believe that that drives people to do less drinking and driving. And we're sitting here with a billion-dollar deficit, and we're saying that we're going to add to $100 million. That was maybe a good bill three years ago, or maybe in the middle here when we had a few extra dollars. But I don't even know. Personally, I don't think it was then either. But if there was a time to do it, it would be a time when we had some extra dollars. But if
Mr. Chair, Senator Day and I will differ on our opinion. And if there are no further discussions, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Artman has a question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, it is not a question. It is a comment. I'm concerned. I think what you've done is put us in a position where we are going to have to either vote for your bill and cut education or health care benefits or somewhere else, or we're going to have to raise taxes and ask ordinary Minnesotans who pay taxes to subsidize the courts and the costs of actually dealing with people that have been convicted of crime. And I don't think that's a very good choice, frankly. I understand what you're trying to do. I understand that. But I don't think that without some solution as to where this money is going to come from, that this is a very good policy for this committee.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, let's, Mr. Senator Chairman, Day. West, can we have a roll call anyway? I mean, you know, even if there's only one no, I'd appreciate it.
Roll call vote has been... Roll call has been
Mr. Chair. We do have an awful light attendance here. Maybe it would be better to wait at some time in the future, like this evening.
Maybe we should report that to the majority leader, that there's nobody in the Transportation Committee. Mr. Chair, I think that a roll call is appropriate. I think it's been asked for, and I think that any member has a right to ask for that. So...
I think there are other members that would like to vote on this, so I would like to lay it over until we reconvene tonight.
That would be fine, Mr. Chair, but I think that even if you did take the roll call vote, it will probably pass because, you know what, the Finance Committee deserved to hear this bill.
and I think I make a compelling case. And I don't know, maybe it will never become law. But the fact of the matter is that for somebody who cares about our justice system being accessible and affordable to people, a justice system that's not affordable, but to the people who can, who have money, is a justice system that's being denied to those people.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, I might have missed part of the conversation. I'd stepped out for a minute. On the DWI driver's license reinstatement surcharge, why is it we're looking at reducing that from 430 to down to 50 in this proposal here?
Senator Dahl, I think that when we made the decision in the 2003 legislative session to increase the fees, we went all across the board and we just identified a whole bunch of fees to increase and add on a whole bunch of surcharges without thinking about the consequences. And I've heard time again that because of the steepness of the DWI installment, the DWI fees and surcharge in order for people, I mean, these are people for whom the court has already made them do their time and have given them the opportunity to come back and get their driver's license. The onerousness of that fee is such that people can't afford to get their driver's license reinstated. And so they're either driving without a driver's license, which leads to driving without getting insurance, which leads to public safety issues. And what we're trying to do is, if we can bring that back into compliance, and I think this committee made the policy decision that it recognized that that fee was very onerous, to go the route of allowing people to do installment payment plans with Senator Latt's bill that became law and the transportation bill. And I think it only follows in the same line that if we are going to allow people who have gone through the court process, they've done their time, the court has given them the opportunity to come back and get their driver's license reinstated, that we should give them a real opportunity to get their driver's license back so that we can have them be in compliance, so that they can have a driver's license, be driving, have auto insurance. It is a public safety issue for us to have people in compliance. And what I'm hearing anecdotally from law enforcement and from the courts is that because the fee is so steep and onerous that people are not reinstating their licenses, and they're just going out there and driving without a driver's license, which is not a good public policy, which is not good for public safety.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore.
Senator Dahl.
I hear what you're saying, but I think with all the fees and fines and everything else they go through, I mean, the $430 is a kind of just change compared to the $10,000 they're probably paying for attorney's fees and things like that. And if we look at the bundle of charges they have, this would just be one other thing that's part of their penalty for the DWI, because, I mean, obviously they're not thinking about the costs that they're inflicting on others, including themselves, once they get behind the wheel. And I agree with pretty much all of your list here, but except for that top one, it seems one area where maybe that was an area where it deserved to be brought up again. Is there someone from you mentioned the police officers and things? Is there someone else that might be able to give us? Not that I don't trust what you're saying, but I'd prefer to hear some testimony, if possible, from someone that could speak directly about why that's. We should change that back. What experiences they're actually having, if that's possible.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I don't have anyone here prepared to respond to that. I just know for a fact that part of the reason why we're going towards this direction is that, and it was presented during Senator Latt's testimony on his bill to do the installment payment plan, that it is becoming increasingly more difficult for people to get their driver's licenses reinstated. So if I think that as we move forward, if it's a matter of concern for this committee, that somehow people who would like to get their driver's license back, even after the courts have allowed them to go back to get their installment driver's license reinstated, somehow we want to categorize them as a separate class of people less worthy of receiving the same relief that we have. I'd be glad to entertain that in conversation with you, Senator Dahl and Senator Ortman and Senator Day, once we get to the Finance Committee. But I really like to send this bill as is to the Finance Committee and keeping the number that we have intact, because I think it is appropriate for the Finance Committee to see the full picture of what the fees and fines and surcharges we imposed in the 2003 session has done as the complete picture.
Madam Chair, Senator Day.
Or Madam Chair. Mr. Chair.
Close enough.
Let's do the roll call and get it out of here.
Well, I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair. I'm going to lay this on the table until the first order of business at 6:30 when we reconvene. There are other members that want to vote on this.
So I doubt that.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if that's the case, then the other bill can wait until tonight when you reconvene, too.
Like to do that?
Yes.
Okay. We have another bill that we are doing as a somewhat of an emergency here. Senate File 3669 by Senator Torres Ray, which needs to be heard and get to the floor yet tonight.
Do we even have it?
What is it? Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is my first time in your committee, so I really appreciate this opportunity, and I'm hoping that I can get your support on a piece of legislation that has been really well an idea that has been well received among small business owners throughout Minnesota. And it came to me, unfortunately, rather late, and that's what I'm asking for your support today and trying to do this quickly. But basically, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 3669 is a bill that will require the Commissioner of Transportation to work on a report that will be submitted to the legislature proposing a program to mitigate the impact of transportation construction projects on small businesses in the state. And part of what has happened, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that in my district I learned a very important lesson. I had a construction project that went on in my district for about 3 years. And this particular project was located in a very important area of my district where there are a number of small businesses that really were negatively impacted by this construction, and many of them are still struggling to really deal with the consequences. Some of these businesses are small coffee shops and businesses of that nature that really cannot afford to have business closed for any for long periods of time, and where parking becomes really an issue because these particular businesses really rely on kind of the daily visits of their customers. And what I learned through this process was that the businesses were not prepared to work with city council members to work on passing ordinances to change parking locations and really work out a plan to let their customers know that they were struggling. What I also learned through that process, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, was that many small business owners in Minnesota really do not ask for help until it is too late. And when they came to me to ask me for some advice and work and for support in working with the city council members to work on ordinances to change parking, for instance, it was late. And, you know, these ordinances take time. There is a process that cities have to go through that will take time. So what this proposal will do is give these particular business owners the opportunity to work out a plan, ask questions, let their customers know that they are going to be facing those problems, and so that people will be more willing to really stop and, purchase the cup of coffee or whatever it is that the business offer. So I had some business owners who wanted to come and testify today, but since we changed the schedule, they are not able to be here. But we will have another opportunity to have this particular bill heard in different committees. And if you have interest, I will be asking those particular business owners to send me the information so that we can distribute it among the members in this committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres Ray, can I assume that this includes and when you say transportation, that it's both roads, bridges, and transit projects that would be affected? The only thing that triggered my my question was that the broad use of transportation, I think, is okay, but when you get to line 1.20, identification of the contact person within the appropriate road authority, could it be road and transit authority or something that would assure that it is not overlooking transit projects as well as road projects?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think that would
Senator
be great
Carr's
because
right.
One of the concerns we have is some of the transit projects that will take a very long time. So if
that would be an appropriate terminology from council, if on like 1.20, after road, insert and transit?
Would be authorities then, plural?
Authorities, right.
Unless there's a more generic term for authority without either one, or?
Senator Olson, I think your suggestion is fine. So the amendment would read insert and transit after the word road and change the word authority to authorities. Oh, I'm sorry.
Each of the.
And Senate also advises that we stick in front of the word the, each of. Oh, I'm sorry.
In front of appropriate.
In front of appropriate. I'll read the whole thing. It would read identification of a contact person within each.
Sorry.
Of the appropriate road and transit authorities who is informed about the construction progress and timing.
And Mr. Chair, on page 2, line 2.16, we need to make the similar change.
And, it also begs the question, but this I know this bill is moving on. If we're going to be including transit, should we be including Metro Transit? The Metropolitan Council in this conversation in some meaningful way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would assume they would be if this is a generic, if this is all-encompassing. That's why by saying road, there's some, like townships or some places would have just road authorities, but there's special transit authorities.
But my point, Senator Olson, is that in the preparation of this report, in the preparation of this report, Metro Transit should be consulted. But I'll just leave that with Senator Torres-Ray. I know this bill, we don't have time and to maybe make that entire fix. I think it's a good suggestion, though. So maybe on the way to business, industry, and jobs, you can figure out how to involve Metro Transit in the preparation of the report. So,
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
What are the changes we're going to make on page 2?
No changes for now on page 2, I don't think.
Okay. Senator Rester.
Amendment.
Okay. Can we take the Olson amendment first?
Sorry, I thought that was just a suggestion. Sorry.
Okay. Do we want to take that as a amendment? Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, did everyone understand the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Okay. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, it's an amendment that makes some changes that we would make if this was proposing an advisory group or something like that. The bill doesn't need to come to my committee, but I think it would make my amendment will make things cleaner for your bill. Mm-hmm. And that would be on line 1-8 to strike everything after the word members, strike line 1-9, strike one line 10, and 1-11 and finance division, and instead insert, so the sentence would read, shall submit a report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate and House committees with jurisdiction over transportation policy and budget, and the Senate and House committees with jurisdiction over economic development policy and finance. And the reason for that part of my amendment is that even though that's the name of the committee right now in the House, When they reorganize, and because I'm going to suggest also a later reporting date, when they reorganize, that might not be the name of the committee. So where you want to send these reports is to whatever committee it is, but the ones that have jurisdiction over transportation policy and budget and economic development policy and budget. And then on 2-1, one of the things that we've started doing is not just having reports or recommendations, but also to make these reports or recommendations include possible draft legislation, so that after the report is done, or part of the report making process or recommendation making process is to suggest how we should change the statutes if that's what is going to be recommended. So I would further amend on line 2.1, after the word recommendations, to insert including possible draft legislation, and to make the same insertion after the word recommendations on line 2.14. Then, further, because I believe that you would want action taken in the legislative bodies that as they are constituted in 2009, that if the report then is not submitted by December 1st, but instead January 15th, that's a common date we are using now in our committee, January 15th, 2009. Then you get the legislature in session in terms of receiving the report, and it not just hanging out there somewhere. So, Mr. Chairman, those are kind of boilerplate changes, but that would be my amendment, and I think it makes your bill work a little better and get stronger, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Senator Rest, and thank you, Senator Mr. Torres-Ray. Chair. I definitely accept these recommendations. They are very good amendments, I think, and help strengthen the language in the bill.
Okay. So to the rest amendment, Senator Dahl?
I'm just a question, I guess, on Section 2 then. It's recommendations developed by the Commissioner of Transportation. If this is going to be, it says in consultation with the Commissioner of Economic Employment and Economic Development and administered by the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, does it make sense that since this is really an economic development issue and employment, that the recommendations be developed by deed in consultation with the transportation instead? And if we're going to make those, and if so, shouldn't we just include that in the amendment? But if it doesn't make sense, then I'm just throwing it out there. I mean, it seems like that's transportation should stick to transportation, and economic development could do it because they're supposed to develop loan grants or grants and loan proposals and things like that, which is outside of the purview, I think, of transportation.
Well, Senator Dahl, that's a more substantive suggestion than a cleanup suggestion.
Right.
So why don't we take Senator Rest's amendment, and then we'll ask Senator Torres-Ray to respond to the substantive question that you have. So all in favor of the Rest amendment? Everyone understands it. Council, most importantly, has got it all. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Senator Torres-Ray, how would you respond to Senator
Mr. Dahl? Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, part of the issue with this is that what we want to do is to initiate the work with the Commissioner of Transportation, with the Department of Transportation, because ultimately they are the only ones who really will know where these particular projects are going to be taking place and then coming up with recommendations. Vision for this is that they will be working in direct connection with the Department with the Economic Development Department. But ultimately, what we want to do is assign this responsibility to the Department of Transportation to start. Now, it is possible that in the process, and we have to figure out next year because these are significant projects that are taking all over the place. And what we really want to do right now is just to start the process of kind of doing this inventory and letting businesses know about it. We really don't know what are some of the recommendations that are going to come up, really, and we don't know the cost of those recommendations as well. So we will have to review that report in 2009 to see what will be, who needs to implement what based on the recommendations that are going to come out. We think that some of the recommendations are going to be really tied to the responsibilities of the city to change parking assigned areas, for instance, and that is really directly transportation, and it is the city's responsibility to do so. So we're really wanting to start with transportation and then figure out, you know, what would be the responsibility of economic development within that process. But we're not clear about that yet.
Right. Mr. Chair and Senator Torres Rey, when I look at this bill, I see two phases to this. One is what transportation is going to do in that area and the impacts it's going to have on that area to businesses. And then the other one is to identify how they can mitigate some of those problems, especially through grants and loans and identification of possible funding sources and things of that nature. And it just seems to me that that's why I bring this up, that that's more of an employment and economic development issue, that transportation could take their information and say, here's, you know, the possible impacts. But that's why I'm suggesting that maybe they're the ones that develop the recommendations and go through identifying who the funding sources are and things like that, especially since they're going to be administering the program. It's at this point in the game, it's not that big of a deal, but it seems to me just from a logistical standpoint, I wouldn't want to put that on the transportation department to try to identify funding sources. They can tell us what the impact is of the planned construction, the nature and extent of the timing, anticipated effects on the business operations, who the contact person is going to be. That all makes sense. But then when it becomes to how to help those businesses mitigate those effects, that seems like it would be a shift of authority over to DEED instead of the transportation department.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dole, since I do have to go to that committee, I will be happy to work with you to see if we can clean up some of that language, kind of to separate perhaps those two responsibilities and make it clearer in here, because I think you're absolutely right that probably the way they are organized in the bill is just not clear enough. But I have to go to that committee, and they probably will have the same questions, so I would really appreciate your help in kind of figuring out a better way to define those two responsibilities before I get to that committee. So I'll be happy to work with you.
Senator Salzman, do you have a motion?
I just have a couple quick thoughts as well, and I'll be very quick because I know you have to leave. It would be helpful, I think, in this bill to also define, and maybe you've discussed this, and I'm sorry if I missed it, is what is a small business? You know, what are we talking about? And also projects, time limit. Is it a year project? I think about the Wakota Bridge, and those businesses have been truly impacted by a construction project. And they didn't get a lot of support in that, and there's questions of what's a detour or just actually, you know, no access. I mean, there's small detours and there's inconvenience, whereas you can't get to your storefront versus your access is a mile away. Mm-hmm. So I think that those would be two things that would need to be considered as well. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the potential financial impact? How do we weigh that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Salzman. I think that is a good suggestion as well. I think that I understand there is a definition of small businesses that exist in statute, but I will check on this and I'll make sure that we incorporate language. If it is not clear, I'll make sure that we define that and also the time limit.
And Senator Salzman, you serve on business, industry, and jobs.
Yes, I do.
All right. So you'll have another crack at this. So do I hear a motion, Senator Salzman?
That I will move it forward?
Yes, to that committee.
To the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, I would like to move Senate File 3669 to Business, Industry, and Jobs, Mr. Chair.
As amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are,
thank you, members.
In recess until 6:30.
Room 123.
Oh, in room 123, members.